Head on to Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to another wonderful week of Conversation Radio on the Horn. This is live. This is as real as it gets. I'm Bob Kincaid. And there are a number of directions in which to go this evening. Some things that are speaking to me to one degree or another. You know, things speak to me, me being a recovering Southern Baptist and all. Sorry, no. This isn't Wednesday. This is Monday. No speaking in tongues. But you get the idea. What's speaking to me this evening? Well, there's a little matter of a law that needs to be taken off the books. I'd say that things are going from worse to worser in places like Pakistan. The Republican level of irrelevance is reaching redefined levels. Not sure if you'd call them high or low, so we'll just call them levels. I mean, when you got to bring Dan Aykroyd back to Saturday Night Live to play John Boner in a skit, well, that was a strange and odd little skit to open Saturday Night Live with this past Saturday night. But how to have, and what made it strange is it wasn't clearly a parody. Usually in one of those Saturday Night Live openings, even the ones where Tina Fey came back to play Godzilla from Wasilla, there was an element of over-the-topness about it, you know, whether it was the silly giggle or, I can see Russia from my house. But this skit on Saturday Night Live with Dan Aykroyd playing John Boner just seemed to be an accurate portrayal of the current crop of dead-from-the-neck-up repiglickins. It just was. It's not that it was unfunny. It was just that it was too real to be funny. Because the Republican Party, as it is currently constituted, is a parody of even back when I always thought I really didn't like Republicans or their party. But it's the same thing with George Bush. You know, every time you thought he'd reached a new low, he dug another sub-basement. It's that way with it. I only thought I disliked them. Now I openly despise them. You know, it's one of those little children screaming and running to mommy moments. And so I think the people who wrote that script, whether Aykroyd had a hand in it or regardless of who wrote it, they couldn't make the Repiglickin Party any weirder or goofier. So they wound up just having to give a fairly accurate portrayal of the Repiglickin Party. And it just, you know, it just was what it was. You know how good Aykroyd is with that whole sort of deep-voiced, faux serious. I don't know. Maybe if he had done John Boner as John Conehead boner or something. But even the Coneheads in their, you know, We Will Rule Earth, were at least, I don't know, there was something more human than human about them. But just check out a little bit of this dialogue, for, you know, strictly for the hell of it. Republican Congressional Leadership Meeting, Friday.
Well, please let us know, because we're all here waiting. All right, here's the deal. Pelosi says the Democratic House and Senate members want to work out their version of the bill and then show it to us for our input.
So basically, we're being cut out.
Looks that way.
All right.
That's great.
Yeah, this is perfect. They're not letting us participate at all.
It's like we don't even exist.
We're totally powerless.
You're right. That's just what we hoped for. Complete political irrelevance. Now, when this stimulus bill causes, you know, the economy to go bad, and I think it could. We could actually have a bad economy. We get to say, don't blame us. We had nothing to do with it. We wanted to leave the economy alone.
Exactly. And unless I've lost my political instincts, that, my friends, is a winning campaign issue.
Yeah. So barring some miracle, next election, we're back in the majority.
You can take it to the bank.
Still, I can't believe he's playing into our hands like this.
Speaking of playing into our hands, did anyone catch the president's press conference this week? What a disaster.
The single most embarrassing public appearance by a U.S. president in history.
Did you see that first question where he was asked about the state of the economy and he proceeds to give a detailed 7-minute answer citing specific figures on unemployment, mortgage default rates, and credit markets, and making the case for government intervention? I'm like, okay, what?
Hello, too much information.
You had me, then you lost me.
It was painful to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I actually felt sorry for the guy. I did.
No, I mean, if it was a fight, they would have stopped it.
And how about where he said, and I kid you not, he actually said this. One thing I'm not going to do is go back to the failed policies of the last 8 years.
Airball!
A swing and a miss.
Definitely not his best moment.
Yeah, that one rolled foul.
Sean Hannity had a great line about the press conference.
Hang on
he
to
said,
this.
This is change we can believe in? Not if you ask me.
That's a great one.
Yeah.
Hannity's brilliant.
Yeah, smartest man in America.
Now, wait a minute. Sean Hannity's the smartest man in America?
In my opinion, yes.
Smarter than Rush?
I think he's as smart as Rush.
No, that's idiotic. No, no one is as smart as Rush Limbaugh. No one! You need to take that back.
Hey, a man's entitled to his opinion.
No, I'm sorry, John. No. Some things are just beyond the pale.
Look, Tom, as Republicans, we don't have to agree on everything.
Another key.
You like Rush? Eric here likes Sean? Someone else might like Michael Savage. We're a big tent party. But at the end of the day, we stick together. And that's the reason we're on such a hot streak.
I agree. Our party's at the top of its game. And that's why now is the perfect time for impeachment.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
We're united. We'll get every Republican vote.
I don't know, Dave. Remember, Obama's only been president for 3 weeks.
I'm telling you, impeaching Obama is a political winner.
No question about that. I just wonder if you're going to get many Democrats to vote for impeachment.
I think they will. I mean, after that press conference Monday... P.U.
He laid an egg with that one.
Yeah.
Look, unless I'm very wrong, a lot of Democrats will be looking to cut this guy loose. I mean, for them, impeachment's the smart move.
My gut tells me it's too soon. Maybe in April.
Well, can we at least raise the issue of the White House sleepovers?
Refresh my memory.
The president said recently that his daughters would be inviting their friends over to the White House for sleepovers.
Huh?
Look, it's a dynamite issue. I mean, we're talking about God knows how many 7 to 10-year-old girls staying over at the White House, wandering around, causing, you know, who knows how much wear and tear on the carpeting? I mean, to say nothing of the increased utility bills and the cost of the snacks involved. I mean, why should the American taxpayer be footing the bill for this madness?
Yeah, you know, and unless I'm politically tone deaf, the whole country is waiting to see those Obama kids taken down a peg. Especially the younger one.
I agree. Going after the Obama girls is political gold. But it's got to be done very carefully, and I'll tell you why. Otherwise, there's a chance it could be counterproductive. Hang on.
You know, the only thing that was found wanting, at least in my opinion, in this whole thing, was they didn't, the makeup artist for Saturday Night Live, didn't make Aykroyd orange enough. Because, you know, John Boehner has that, I mean, he is, he's like carrot orange from all his time on the tanning bed. But the rest of that, going after those Obama girls, political gold. On the one hand, this is all, this, like, well, I think you've got an idea of what I was talking about. That sounded like reality. That sounded like how Republicans do what passes for thinking in the thin gray settlings that happen to be between their ears and pass for brains. They are in their battle of the bulge, and they are running out of fuel. It's entirely possible that we could see the Republican Party reduced to absolute irrelevance in a matter of 2 or 3 years. I know that there are people in this audience. And I'm not, who think that there are problems with the so-called stimulus bill. I just say so-called stimulus bill because calling it a stimulus bill, honey, I loved a tough night last night. Could I have a hot cup of stimulus? You see what I'm saying? It's to Madison Avenue. This attempt to revitalize and reshape the way America does business so that America can again do business stands at you. There's some stuff in it I'm not crazy about. A lot of the tax cuts, I'm not crazy about. Mainly because I take the word of people like Paul Krugman who say that you don't tax cut your way out of a mess like this. And apparently the Obama administration's not real happy about it. They don't like the breadth and scope that was added into the compensation limits that were placed. And of course, Wall Street bankers are screaming, "Oh, we'll have a brain drain. There'll be a talent. There'll be a defection of talent from Wall Street." Oh, please. But this might work. Or it might begin to work. This isn't, I have a feeling this is not, it's not like the Obama administration just said, here's the stimulus bill, this'll fix it. Not by any stretch of the imagination. But we are potentially on the road to getting some stuff fixed. And if it succeeds even a little bit, if it looks like it's working, the Republican Party is dead. It's just dead. You know, Monty Python coughing up blood on the stoop, dead. Pining for the fjords, dead. But I really wish they'd made Dan Aykroyd a little more orange. Because that's one of the things that makes John Boehner so especially creepy, is when he starts weeping those alligator tears down over that sort of soil of Mars-colored flesh of his. It's like watching an alien cry. That's exactly what it is. But that's just one of the things for this evening. I wouldn't be doing justice if I didn't go, well, let's backtrack. We've been at this, you and I, all of us, long enough that we understand that there is a serial, S-E-R-I-A-L, quality to this program from time to time. We talk about the things, we back-reference things that we have talked about in previous shows, and Friday night was a very, very special evening. Friday night, you heard a lot of the truth, a lot of facts about mountain removal and about the dirty business that was done in Richmond to open the floodgates to the mass destruction of everything we know as Appalachia in the name of, you know, the Holy Prophet. That's Prophet with an F and an I. And I want to backtrack to something that our pal Reverbo had shared with us. Read it again. This is from the 1973 masterpiece by Kurt Vonnegut, Breakfast of Champions. The truck carrying him was in West Virginia now. The surface of the state had been demolished by men and machinery and explosives in order to make it yield up its coal. The coal was mostly gone now. It had been turned into heat. The surface of West Virginia, with its coal and trees and topsoil gone, was rearranging what was left of itself in conformity with the laws of gravity. It was collapsing into all the holes which had been dug into it. Its mountains, which had once found it easy to stand by themselves, were sliding into valleys now. The demolition of West Virginia had taken place with the approval of the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of the state government, which drew their power from the people. Here and there an inhabited dwelling still stood. He marveled at how recently white men had arrived in West Virginia, and how quickly they had demolished it for heat. ''73, Kurt Vonnegut, Breakfast of Champions, written 3 years after the opening of the first mountain removal job in West Virginia. I don't think I can put too fine a point on the degree of shock and sadness, of horror, that rippled throughout the community of activists struggling to keep that prophecy from coming fully true at the news of what the Fourth Circuit in Richmond, Virginia had done to this state that has had, this region that has had so very much already done to it. And so I just sort of sent that around to folks, and there was a general sense of wonder at that language. Well, then over the weekend I received word from our friends down at Coal River Mountain Watch, who have a little office in Whitesville, with a mural painted on it, just a mountain scene, an Appalachian mountain scene. But for the second time in as many weeks, the office had been vandalized. The first time through, it was just a generalized egging of the front of the building. Classy, huh? Gotta love the coal thugs. This time, however, the vandals took aim at the mural on the side of the building, that aforementioned Appalachian Mountain scene. Coming in and hastily and none too talentedly painting bulldozers on the mountains. That's them. That's how they operate. This is what we have going forward. On message boards related to newspapers in the state, people who work on mountain removal sites but live nowhere near them. Crow with glee, I love mountains that have coal in them. Set the charges. And get away with it. There was another bit of peaceful resistance today as nonviolent activists attempted to chain themselves to the drills on mountain sites that bury those same charges that Timothy McVeigh used in Oklahoma City in the hearts of our mountains. They were nonviolent. They were peaceful. And yet the West Virginia media, wholly owned subsidiaries as they are of the coal industry, persist, as I told you last week, in painting them as potentially deadly eco-terrorists. When nothing could be further from the truth. But then again, we've talked a little bit, and I've had one of those Rick Goodner horn psychotherapist white courtesy phone moments. What these monsters are doing is transference, because there are eco-terrorists in Appalachia. There are lots of eco-terrorists in Appalachia. One of them was featured on Valentine's Day in the New York Times. Our buddy Mara was kind enough to send it along to me. It was the story of Don Blankenship and what he has done to try to corrupt the judicial process in West Virginia. And this should be, it's being painted, touted as one of the most one of the biggest cases that will be coming out of the Supreme Court of the United States this term. The question of what a judge should do when he has met with, has talked to, a litigant with cases before his court, and is the beneficiary of multiple millions of dollars used to defeat his opponent in an election. This all relating to the 2004 election in which Don Blankenship supported the candidacy of this the lard-ass by the name of Brent Benjamin, who claimed to have family values. You know the drill. And then Benjamin refused to recuse himself from multiple tens of millions of dollars in litigation against Don Blankenship's company, Massey. The Supreme Court will hear it. I will tell you now that I will be pleasantly surprised if the Supreme Court of the United States does the ethical thing and strikes down Justice Benjamin from ever hearing anything relating to Massey Energy. It is too much to hope that his election would be invalidated because of the sleazy activities of Don Blankenship. But this is, after all, a court wherein one Antonin Fat Tony Scalia sits, and who went off on more than one killing vacations with Dick Cheney when Dick Cheney had litigation pending before the court. So I don't have just a whole bunch of, I don't have a whole bunch of confidence in the court to get this one right. Because if anything, if we know anything, we know that Alito has corporate accountability problems in his portfolio. And the same may likely be said for Roberts, Fat Tony Scalia, Slappy Thomas, and Tony Kennedy. That's five for those of you scoring at home. Even with Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the best of health, there's only four on her side counting herself. So I think we've got an idea how this all plays out. Corruption for everyone. Charming, isn't it? So that's where we find ourselves this evening. I want to share some audio with you, also provided by our friend Maura, that will give you an idea of how priorities shake out here in West Virginia. It's 26 minutes past the hour, and let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Scott calling from Salem. How you doing?
Scott, how are you? Good to hear from you.
Yeah, I'm doing great. How you doing?
Pretty good.
Yeah. You sent me an email about this Fourth Circuit decision and then sent me the link, and I went and scanned it. And it is it's pretty disgusting, actually.
It's like the legalistic version of a snuff film, as far as I can tell.
I thought your comment was great, though. Some of the best legal reasoning the 16th century has to offer. That's so classic.
I couldn't resist I think I mentioned I chose the 16th century for a reason, because that's when all the legal mumbo jumbo began that eventually led to the dispossession of native peoples from their land, led to the enslavement of human beings. The 16th century is not exactly it's not a high water mark for legal reasoning and human rights and that kind of thing.
Yeah, no kidding. I was just looking through this, and I thought it would be interesting just to give a little bit of the atmospherics of this case, because I've seen this kind of thing on several occasions with things that I've been working on as well, and I just think it's fascinating. So if you could let me just read a couple of things from the
absolutely, please. I was hoping we would get the benefit of your insight on this.
So some of this is really more about telling a story than about getting into any sort of detailed legal reasoning or whatever. It's a little scary to even attempt to do that with this opinion. But if you just start on the first page, and give folks a sense of what one of these things looks like, right? It's a very formalized document. But the very first page starts out, first few pages actually, starts out and tells you who the players are. And it's actually very instructive. So you read the caption, and it says, United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, Coal River Mountain Watch, West Virginia Highlands Conservancy, Plaintiffs Appellate, and Colmac Incorporated versus Arakoma Coal Company, Elk Run Coal Company, Alex Energy Incorporated, Independence Coal Company Incorporated, defendants and appellants, and Mingo Logan Coal Company, interveners and defendants, and then it's a bunch of folks from the Army Corps of Engineers who are the defendants in the case. But then comes, that's not it, right? I mean, couldn't just have a nice scrum between these folks.
No, no.
Here come the Amici, who are the folks who filed amicus briefs in support of the appellants. That would be National Mining Association, Kentucky Coal Association, Coal Operators and Associates Incorporated, Illinois Coal Association, Colorado Mining Association, Alaska Miners Association, Virginia Coal Association, Idaho Mining Association, Alabama Coal Association, Pennsylvania Coal Association, Ohio Coal Association, Indiana Coal Council Incorporated, Utility Water Act Group, West Virginia Department of Commerce, West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection, as Amici supporting the appellants. I mean, this So this just gives, you know, people the sense of who the fight is between, right?
Right, and let me just throw something in there real quick, Scott. You named the parties on the take care, you know, protect West Virginia side of the thing, and it was OVEC and Coal River Mountain Watch and the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy.
Right.
They're all represented by one lone lawyer.
Exactly. This is my point.
I mean, this is worse than High Noon. I mean, this is Gary Cooper standing in the street with the entire Gambino crime family at the other end, armed to the teeth.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, who was on the other side? I mean, one of the things that you don't see when you see the opinion, but you do see when you're looking at the briefs, is you actually see who these people are represented by. I'm sure it's pretty much every sort of big law firm or a whole list of big law firms on their side.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's what, when I was working.
Armies of lawyers.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, right? I mean, this is what you need to understand, what people need to understand when they think about using the courts as a tool to do the right thing. Right? I mean, clearly, this is what you're trying to do, right? You're trying to actually get the Army Corps to do what it's supposed to do and to follow the laws that, you know, Congress intended the law to work a certain way. And all you're trying to do is get your chance to say, these guys are playing fast and loose. We just want them to play by the rules. And look who shows up, right? I mean, you're really going to win this fight? It's as hard can possibly be. And I think that's part of the narrative. But the other thing I wanted to read from, which I just thought was just so gross, is it starts at the beginning of the opinion. And that the judge, this is sort of typical the way these things go. The judge starts out with the sort of posture of the case. This comes to us on appeal, blah, 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 right? And then Roman numeral one. So this is the first actual thing that the court's going to say about the case. And it starts out, and you can usually tell. You can usually tell how things are going to go within a couple of sentences of Roman numeral number one.
I'm glad to know I'm not the only one who reads a case that way.
No, it's totally true. I mean, you can definitely tell. So here's Roman numeral number one. The mountaintop removal method of surface coal mining pioneered in West Virginia.
Pioneered jumped out at me, too.
I mean, you know, pioneered.
Daniel Boone with a bulldozer.
It makes it sound like, you know, after we did that, we sent a man to the moon, you know, and we cured polio and we did some other, you know.
I mean,
come on, right? It's one of the great sort of technological exports of West Virginia is mountaintop removal mining. It involves the blasting of the coal and rock atop a mountain to expose coal deposits below. While mine operations are ongoing, the overburden is hauled or pushed into adjacent valleys. This excavated overburden is known as spoil, in quotes. Once the coal has been excavated, efforts are made to recontour the mountaintop by replacing the removed overburden. But stability concerns limit the amount of spoil that can be returned to the area. In its natural state, the spoil material is heavily compacted. Once excavated, however, the loosening of the rock and the soil and the incorporation of air causes significant swelling. As a result, large quantities of the blast material cannot be replaced, and this excess spoil or overburden remains in the valley, creating a valley fill that buries intermittent and perennial streams in the process.
You know, the last time I had something mingled with air that was swelling, I had to go to the doctor and get a big dose of penicillin.
Exactly. It makes it all sound like, it makes it sound like they've made a milkshake or something.
Yeah.
You know? It used to be all compacted. Now it's not light and fluffy, you know. It's just.
Yeah, it's either a floor wax or a dessert topping.
Exactly. I mean, and you can tell what's going to happen. The thing that I find amazing in the decision, and I only scanned it, but it brings back every bad dream I've had of reading dozens of these cases over the years, is I find it so fascinating when an appeals court looks at a lower court's ruling and asks the question, was the lower court deferential enough to the agency? As opposed to asking and never asking the question, are we being deferential enough to the lower court?
Well, see, that kind of got to me too, Scott, because aren't there just bright line carved in stone rules about the deference that a reviewing court owes to the trial court?
That's how it's supposed to work. Right?
I mean, and it works that way because the trial court was there. The trial court heard the testimony. The trial court sat not only as the finder of law, but the finder of fact.
Right.
The trial court was able to sit there and watch for instance, Army Corps of Engineers people come on and testify. The trial court was able to judge the credibility of the witnesses. In other words, you know, to make a ruling based upon the totality of the circumstances. How do you not afford that some degree of deference in its own right?
No, I mean, that's the idea, right? The idea is that the district court, you know, these are complicated cases. You've got people coming and giving their opinions on either side. And the veracity of those witnesses is really important in terms of in determining how you weigh the evidence on either side. Seeing them, actually seeing these people and hearing the question and hearing how they respond is an important part of it. And that's exactly what the district court is supposed to do, and it's exactly what the appeals court is supposed to stay out of. Right? So the appeals court is supposed to say, does this opinion shock the conscience? Right? Does it say, wait a minute, you know, the district court opinion? Did the district court do something so egregious that it's really a bad statement about the way the whole sort of judicial system works? Because they ignored people who, they ignored evidence, or they didn't allow evidence to be heard, or they made some significant procedural errors that denied someone their right to appear or to be heard. Things like that, right?
Sure.
Not this kind of thing where they're going over the details of the engineers' reports. It's ridiculous.
Well, you know, we see this kind of thing go on, and it happens at the trial court level, too. There was a recent injunction hearing down in Huntington, Scott, in which at the last minute, literally the last minute, and I don't want to get too technical, you know and can probably describe the rules of how one goes about disclosing witnesses. In other words, everybody knows who's going to testify.
Right.
Well, at the last minute, an undisclosed witness from a county commission was brought on to the stand to testify that if this injunction went forward, the entire county would go bankrupt.
Oh, jeez.
Our side was not offered, you know, a lengthy recess in which to find or you know, even a recess to allow deposition of this witness. Nothing. The guy was just allowed to get on the stand and testify. It's all going to go to hell. So, you know, that's uphill with one foot in a bucket. That's that kind of procedural unfairness. But you know, and it's the same judge that issued the ruling that it got overturned here. It's not like you cannot make a credible claim that Robert C. Chambers, the district judge who issued the underlying decision, you can't make a credible claim that this guy was abusing his discretion or shocking the conscience.
Right.
He gives the coal industry and the Army Corps of Engineers, he gives them every bit of latitude. But the fact of the matter is, in his underlying opinion, he wrote very plainly that the impact of this process was so profound as to require affording the plaintiffs the relief that they sought. And the Fourth Circuit comes along and paints this picture of coal executives in their buckskin trousers with their bulldozers and their trusty Indian sidekicks outside being what? Pioneers?
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree with that. I think it's so interesting. So people who are in the business understand what happens, right? I mean, the appeals courts have tools that they can use to get to pretty much whatever answer they want, right? So when they want to agree with the court below, they say, well, you know, we have a very high standard of deference to the court below. You know, for all the reasons you listed, we weren't there, we can't judge the veracity of the witnesses, blah, 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 right? And then they just step aside and let the thing move through unchanged, right? Then they have, if they decide that they want to review the court below, they have this great thing I think we talked about this before, this business about deference to the agency, the Chevron deference thing, right?
Yes.
And everyone in the industry knows, in the legal field knows, that Chevron deference is a joke. That the idea behind Chevron deference is that the courts plays this little bit of kabuki theater where they say, if the law is plain on its face, if you can tell just by reading it what you're supposed to do, then we ask, did the agency do what the law said? And if they didn't, we reverse them. If they did, we follow through. However, if the language of the statute is unclear or ambiguous, then we have to give deference to the agency's interpretation of that, because we're not the experts. The agency is the experts, right? And so you can imagine what they do. They say, when they want to overturn the agency, they say the language is clear and the agency got it wrong. And then they want to do what the agency did. They say, well, you know, the language isn't entirely clear, and you know, therefore we have to give deference to them because it's their field of expertise, and on they go, right? And that's what they did here. They basically said, the Army Corps of Engineers has the latitude to decide what the law means, right? Which is outrageous, really. I mean, it's one thing to say they have deference to figure out how they're going to implement the law. Are they going to meet every 60 days? Are they going to meet every 120 days? You know, how many reports are they going to get from biologists versus geologists, things like this? But when the Army Corps says we don't have to even address certain issues, that's, you know, we've decided we don't have to address certain issues here, certain impacts, that's just wrong. The law doesn't say that. The law says that they do need to address those impacts. It's not theirs to decide what they're going to ignore when the law says that they have to treat these things, or they have to address these issues. And when the court says, when the court gives deference to the Corps to decide what it's even going to consider, whether it's going to consider certain impacts, that's giving the Corps the ability to basically rewrite what Congress has written. That's just not good law.
Well, that is the very heart and soul textbook definition of abuse of discretion, right? I mean, the Corps is given certain discretion, as you've described it, and then in deciding just to not implement parts of it, they abuse the discretion that they're given.
This is the whole deal, right? The whole deal is when Congress says, you, the agency, are charged with doing these things. The part of the deal that makes it fair, that makes it not arbitrary and capricious, right, is that the agency, the Corps, at least tries to address what Congress told them to address. They do their best, right? But when they say, yeah, I know you gave us this menu of seven things to do, but we've decided we're only going to really do four of them, that's arbitrary and capricious. They've decided to just disregard three of them on their own, even though they've been directed by Congress to address all seven of those things. I think the trick in this case, where didn't they go back and do some more hearings and get some more public comments? Isn't that what happened?
It was a very long, drawn out process, Scott. There was some of that sort of thing.
And I think that was the trick. I think they actually said, well, you know, we went back and we did some more stuff. So it makes them look like they're trying to do their best and everything, right? And that leaves this huge hole for the court to say, well, you know, they did their best, and they even went back and did some more.
And that puts people who are trying to protect this state kind of in a hole, Scott, because, you know, as I mentioned, I was at one of these public hearings the other night, and there was a Freudian slip part of the way through it, when the guy from the Department of Environmental Protection stood up and said, this permit that we're renewing tonight. Well, that wasn't. And he got called on it by the crowd, too. But anybody, if you were to see, I mean, if you were to have the hard copy record in front of you of people who oppose these things versus people who support them, it would be like the difference between the Oxford Unabridged Dictionary and an Archie Comics. and that's the written comment period. And in this particular instance, and in other instances too numerous to mention, the same thing happens. But it's the company versus the people, individual voices versus a conglomerated massively wealthy voice. And don't think for an instant.
Also,
go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. The company also, the companies have a strong financial interest to show up to every single meeting. And in fact, they've been talking to the agency, to the Corps or to the DEP or whoever it is, long before the meeting even gets started. Right? Because these guys, that's what they get paid to do. When they show up at one of those meetings, they're at work. Right? When I show up, you know, that's after work for me. This is not my job. I show up and say, well, wait a minute, I'm concerned about these things. And dozens of other people in the meeting are all people who are there on their own time. The guys that are there from industry are actually at work during that meeting.
Yeah, they're on the clock.
They're on the clock. And they're, and you know, what you, one of the things that I've also learned from being a sort of on the inside of the business is, these guys had been meeting with the agency long before the public comment even begins.
Yes.
And that's why the agency sort of feels like, you know, we're here tonight to renew this permit. Because they're working with those guys day in and day out, and they say, oh yeah, that's right, we gotta do this public comment thing. Right?
Well, there's a notice out right now, Scott, of this big to-do being hosted by West Virginia's biggest, meanest, nastiest law firm, Jackson and Kelly. It's referred to as the law firm where widows and orphans claims go to die. They've been screwing landowners and affected community members since long about the time of the Civil War. They happened when the railroads started coming through and when the timber interests and the coal interests cropped up. They were the ones who wrote the deeds that they took along with a jug of liquor and had had the Mountaineer sign up the holler.
Yep. I see they're actually on this brief too.
Oh, yes, they are. At least largely hosting a shindig coming this month, in which they're having the whole industry there. You know, there'll be booze and shrimp and, you know, all the shilly shallying that goes along with it, and they're giving out awards. And guess who the invited guests are, beyond the coal companies? Well, the special invited guests are the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection.
No kidding. Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. Here's your seat at the head table. Enjoy your shrimp.
Yeah. And I mean, why should that not be deemed unethical contact?
Yeah, you would think they would be, you know, what happens when you have a contact like that? You'd have to recuse yourself, right? You'd have to recuse yourself from any agency business that involves that client. That's what you're supposed to do.
You would think.
That's what the AP, the Administrative Procedure Act actually says that's what you're supposed to do. Because the whole point of public comment, I mean, it's the idea, right? The nice sort of quaint idea is that the government comes up with an idea, a proposed policy, like we're going to try to keep the rivers clean. And then, you know, something like this comes up where there's a particular, you know, there's mining operations, and people say, okay, how are we going to do mining operations in a way that protects the streams? And the agency says, well, let's propose some regulations for how that should be done. They're supposed to do that on their own, based on agency expertise. And then they open it up for public comment. And then it's supposed to come the people from all the different sides, all the different factions, supposed to have their day and have the chance to get their issues out. And then the agency is supposed to consider all those and then put out the regulation in response to the comments. And they're supposed to detail how they responded to all of the different constituency concerns and so forth, right? That's a nice idea, right? It actually sounds like a kind of a neat way to run your government.
It sounds like participatory democracy.
Yeah, it sounds like that, right? And the law is even written that way. If you read the law, you become convinced that that's actually what the story is, right? That's totally not what happens. I mean, there's nothing in there about, you know, the shrimp cocktail and the swanky party held by the law firm.
Single malt scotch by the barrel, yes.
Yeah, you know, and that basically tells you that that's the reality, right? I mean, I know this the firm that I was formerly working at has an environmental group that makes sure that their clients get in front of the agency early and often, long before any of that stuff gets out for public comment. By the time, and that's what the thing's 95% written by the time that it comes out. And it's 95% written by the agency and the commercial interest. These are the folks that can show up at the agency on Wednesday at 10:30 for a meeting. Because guess what? They're at work when they're doing that.
Yes.
You know, I can't show up at the agency at 10:30 on a Wednesday. You know, I got a job, right? And I can't show up. You know what they do? They set up a meeting. We're going to have a meeting on this every first and third Wednesday for 3 months. And guess who shows up to every single meeting? Hey, the industry, right? Or
yeah.
The lawyers. You know, so it's no wonder that it turns out the way that, and this is before the thing's even pushed out for public comment. That's not considered public comment. You know, that's considered informal rulemaking. It's really, it's part of what really sort of depressed me about this whole way of trying to actually get anything made right, you know, anything done, because you show up and, the folks that argue the case, they're doing their best. I mean, we did the same thing. We had one of these Clean Water Act cases, did it with a bunch of law students and a law professor. And on the other side, you've got, you know, five or six big law firms, each of which have four or five people working on it basically around the clock. And it happens this way again and again as every procedural maneuver you can imagine are trying to throw you out for standing. And it's just like, you can't budge an inch without getting just drilled by these people. And it just makes you, I mean, it made me feel like, there must be a better way.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the phrase kabuki theater. That you feel like a set dresser there, right?
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. You know how it's going to end. You know.
Yeah, we've all seen Macbeth.
There's something completely different happening behind the scenes, right? So, you know, you're just sort of playing your part, like you said, right? And you're playing your part waiting for the thing to get to its inevitable conclusion. Sometimes it has to go all the way up to the Supreme Court. But, you know what's going to happen when it gets there.
Were you, because I mentioned this, Scott, because I was. You touched earlier on this argument and this specious argument put forward by the court about deference, about judging whether the trial court was appropriately deferential to state agencies.
Right.
Because this was, you know, the last I checked, the Army Corps of Engineers is not a state agency.
That's right. Yeah.
Robert E. Lee was a member of the Army Corps of Engineers, for God's sakes. But the ruling goes on to talk about the deference due and owing to a state agency. And maybe I was just so pissed off that this is where my mind went. But when you've got a judge talking about deference to state agencies, isn't that sort of an administrative style states' rights argument?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what I thought when I read it. Exactly what I thought.
And that's just noxious.
It's terrifying, actually, because you know how that argument's been used in the past.
Yeah, and that's why I spent the weekend with this thing, and it didn't get any reading after reading after reading. It didn't get any better, Scott.
Yeah,
it kept ending the same way. And I just sat there, and words like Dred Scott and Plessy kept running through my mind.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think it's also fascinating because it says, you know, you've got a federal scheme. The Clean Water Act is a federal scheme, right? It's a federal scheme for a good reason. And, you know, the deference to the state agencies over things it's interesting. I hadn't thought about it this way, but so when does the court give deference to the states? So the Constitution says basically, if we haven't claimed jurisdiction over it, then the states have jurisdiction over it, right?
Right.
That's the idea. I mean, the idea is supposed to be in those things, in those areas where the federal government really has no business, let the states do whatever they want. That's their business, and we're not going to touch it. But this isn't one of those cases, right?
Yeah, whether or not there's a red light at the corner of South and Main is best decided by local government.
Exactly, exactly. You know, a variety of people have made that argument about marriage laws, and there's a variety of sort of more local things with it. Maybe that's
but you know, one of the other things that popped into my tiny little mind, Scott, was I started thinking about other areas where, in fact, the federal government has left matters up to the states. And the first one that popped into my mind, although marriage is a really good one, the first thing that popped into my mind was election law.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that you've got 50. Actually, more than 50 separate standards for how a free and fair election will be conducted.
Right.
And that's not working out real well anymore.
No. And you could have the. I've always found that a little bit odd because some of the most interesting cases in that area can have to do with things like, gerrymandering of districts,
right?
Of congressional districts. And the federal government the federal judiciary will actually step in there if it thinks what's happened is the states have denied people their right to vote, essentially. Right? They've so diluted out a minority that the minority never really has the chance to vote together to put somebody that they like in power.
Unless it's the current court, and I think about that district in Texas with the quarter mile wide strip that runs between Austin and Dallas or whatever it is.
Right. But I think we can get into the details of that, but I think that they definitely waded in there. And I think you can extend that argument. You could say, it is certainly the federal government's business to make sure that people in the individual states have a fair and accurate election procedure. I don't understand why the federal government would say that that's not their concern. It seems basic to the democracy that the votes are counted. Why that's not a federal concern, I've never understood that. But, whatever. Selective reading of the Constitution, I guess.
Right.
But I think what you're saying with the states' rights thing here is fascinating because it's this funny thing where they say Clean Water Act allows, the way the Clean Water Act works says the EPA, federal EPA, is going to administer this program unless you, the state, put together a program that meets all the requirements of the law, in which case we'll let you run it. Okay? And that's supposed to be the idea, right? The state agency, it knows the state better, it knows the actors better, whatever.
No, the topography, sure.
Yeah, it knows the economic needs of the state and so forth, right? Okay, fair enough.
Or, the hydrology. The hydrology of West Virginia is very different from the hydrology of Louisiana.
Right, so you get the chance to have some actual expertise there, right? People in Louisiana know a lot more about local conditions than the federal government's going to if the federal government's running the program. So that's all well and good. That sounds reasonable, right?
Yeah, because it's a rejection of the idea that one could craft a one-size-fits-all policy for various and sundry different geographic and hydrologic locations.
Right. And that seems to be consistent with reality, right? It's not an insane policy. It makes sense, right? But that's not the same as saying, having decided that we're going to give the states agencies authority to enforce this law, that's not the same as saying, we've given them the authority to decide whether they're going to enforce it or not. Right? I mean, they don't get to make that decision. As long as what the states are doing is enforcing the laws written, they're okay, and they can use their own local expertise. But they can't say, in West Virginia, we just don't really care about the waters of the United States as much as other people do, so we're not going to enforce or even consider these four or five sections of the Clean Water Act because it's inconvenient for us.
Because for all intents and purposes, we're going to deem that they're not the waters of the United States. Because isn't that one of the operative phrases to the Clean Water Act? The waters of the United States?
Yeah.
It's a recognition that, for instance, the Monongahela River rises in West Virginia, but the next thing you know, it's in Pittsburgh.
Right. No, that's exactly right. And that's the whole purpose of the Clean Water Act the idea is that the waters of the United States are sort of a national resource worth protecting. And it's interconnected. And what you can't allow is you can't allow the individual states to sort of take a race to the bottom and decide that any individual state wants to pollute as much as it can, because the impacts on the country as a whole are just too substantial. At least that's the idea. Right? And that's what I find remarkable about this argument that when we defer to a state agency, it's sort of a state's rights thing. The federal government has to actually keep its hands off in a way that it doesn't when it's doing it, when it's overseeing the laws itself, when the federal government's overseeing them. And that's just not right. That's just sort of incorrect from a logical standpoint.
And yeah. I mean, it seems to me, although I didn't see it taken up to any significant degree, there's an equal protection question here, isn't there?
Yeah. There tends to be that. It gives you that gut feeling, right? Doesn't it just feel like in your gut there's an equal protection problem?
Yeah, because otherwise you're left with the Fourth Circuit saying that all West Virginians are equal. And they've got the equal protection of the laws, but the guy who's on top of the mountain with the high explosives and the machinery is a little bit more equal than the guy living on family land that he's been on for nine generations at the foot of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you can argue that those two are equal is if you say, well, you know, if the guy at the foot of the mountain wants to get some explosives, he can go blow up a mountain too.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. No, that's the logic, right? Yeah.
And when you get into this equal protection stuff, then the next thing you're dealing with really is a Plessy-style separate but equal sort of social stratification.
Yeah. I mean, so I think this is, because we could talk about that too, right? Equal protection is another, it's a great sounding idea, but then when you actually try to use it as a lever to do anything, you find that the courts have just completely gutted it.
Right, just like the Fourth Amendment.
Exactly. And so it brings me back to basically back to the beginning where you say, I think this is an important lesson to learn about this. This is why national elections are so important, right? Because this problem with this case could easily be fixed with the sort of stroke of the pen in Congress, right? The Congress could just make explicit what it considers necessary for doing the environmental analysis. They just make it explicit. They could just make explicit what kind of permits are allowed and what permits aren't allowed under the Surface Mining and Reclamation Act. Right? They could make that trivially clear, and then the courts would just have to shut up. There'd be nothing for the courts to discuss. Right?
It would be like the Lilly Ledbetter law that was recently passed.
Now, which was this?
Now, this was the lady who was cheated out of fair pay for 20
yeah.
years.
Right.
But the Supreme Court said that because she didn't file suit immediately, when she started being cheated as opposed to when she knew she was being cheated, that she was, her statute had run.
Right. Yep.
And the Congress came back. It was the first thing that Obama signed into law was the Lilly Ledbetter Pay Equity Act.
Yep.
Congress stepped in and said, we are effectively gutting that decision of the Supreme Court. So the same thing could be done here. It's a question, however, of one of will. We had, I can never remember the exact number, 148, I think, co-sponsors of the Clean Water Protection Act, which was an outright clarification of the sort of pornography that had been done to the Clean Water Act. We had 147 co-sponsors for that in the House last Congress, Scott.
Yeah.
It got killed by, among others, my congressman.
Yeah.
It was killed in the Senate by Robert Byrd. And here we are starting all over again.
Yeah, but I have to say, we talked, when you and I talked about the election the last time, there's a lot of ground to cover since then, but we were talking about, once Dennis was pushed out of the race, what was going to happen? And you talked about, I was in a sort of a bad mood, and I was saying, look, it doesn't matter anymore. I don't really care, right? And you said, well, it does matter because whoever's in next will determine who the Supreme Court the composition of the Supreme Court. And so it matters, right? And I think this is right. I think that we have to remember that these are long view questions, right? We're not going to get this legislation fixed immediately. What we're going to have to do is we're going to have to keep pounding on it. We're going to have to keep putting people in office like Obama and giving the Democrats control of the Congress. And we're going to have to keep and we can't just walk away at that point, right? We have to keep pushing on this. We have to keep bringing up cases like this as much for their narrative quality as anything else. You know, you don't really even expect to win the case yet. You just expect to put the case up there and let the court show how disgusting its logic is so that you can get more and more people to say, you know what? We've got to get people, judges like this, off the bench. We've got to put sane people in that job because those guys are there for 20, 25, 30, 35 years. So this is the sort of long-term thinking that you told me about and has really been on my mind a lot, you know, sort of this idea that we've got to build durable institutions. I was just reading this book called The Invisible Hands, which is a book about the rise of the conservative movement following the New Deal all the way up through Reagan. And, you know, these guys are serious. I mean, you and I talked about the Powell memo before, but this takes that and makes it look like child's play. These guys have been working for 40 years.
Yes.
Straight.
Doggedly, determinedly.
The National Association of Manufacturers and the Chamber of Commerce and the Association of Capital Formation and all these other crazy groups, right? They get built up and write papers and get economics pieces put into the newspaper and get their stuff before Congress as part of the analysis day in and day out. And I think that we need to understand that we have to do exactly the same thing. Right? We have to make long-term investments in sort of structural change, you know, trying to influence the narrative, which is one of the reasons why I think.
Well, you know, one of the things that really hangs in my craw, though, Scott, is the knowledge of the author of this particular decision. This guy's a Clinton appointee.
Yeah. So what does that say? What does that tell you?
It tells me that that the only way you rise into these positions is by doing corporate America's bidding, with very few exceptions.
I mean, I think we've said this, right? Clinton was one of the best Republican presidents we ever had.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, you've got to remember, I mean, Clinton was very much a sort of economic engine, pro-capitalist. I mean, you know, Clinton was the one who also put in some of the he was the one who actually signed into law that thing that prevented the Securities and Exchange Commission from regulating derivatives.
True.
It had a huge part to do with what the collapse we just had.
And,
you know, that was Clinton. That wasn't Bush.
No.
It bummed me out when I heard that, but I guess it wasn't, you know, too surprising.
No, sadly, it's not. But the let me shift gears for a minute, Scott, and just ask you a procedural question because you may be I'm sure you're more up on this than I am. On a petition for rehearing en banc, which is for those not used to the funky legal terms of the legal world, that's a circuit court petition to have it heard by the whole court. How routinely are those granted?
It's sort of, I think the standard is similar to the standard that the Supreme Court uses when it wants to decide whether it wants to take cert on something. And so I think what you have to have is I believe that this is the case, you have to raise a series of conflicting cases within the circuit. So you say, you know, the Fourth Circuit has touched on this.
Oh, so the fact that our groups are 0-4 in the Fourth Circuit kind of dooms us.
You're going to have a hard time getting en banc hearing there because you don't have, I mean, it's not like, you know, when these three guys are on the court, they vote one way. But when these, so people understand that the appeals court is made up of a larger panel of judges, subgroups of them actually hear these cases. So there'd be, I think there were three on this?
Yes.
Three judges.
South Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia. The first time a West Virginian has sat on the panel. And oddly enough, he's the one who concurred in part and dissented in part.
Right, which I thought was actually pretty well done. So it would be like, you know, every time guys A, B, and C are on, you get one answer. But every time guys D, E, and F are on, you get a different answer. And so you need to get guys A through F together in a room and figure out what the answer is. Right? That's what en banc means. It means put all of the guys together and make them hear it as a case amongst a much bigger court, not just a three-person court. And I think the way that you typically get that is when you can say, yeah, your decisions are incoherent within the circuit. Not that your decisions differ from another circuit, they'll say, yeah, that's because they're the ninth circuit. They're a bunch of lunatics over there, right? You have to say there's something wrong within your circuit. You guys better get your act together. Get together in a room and figure out what the answer is to this question.
So in other words, if, say, there was a similar case in Kentucky, which is a different circuit, and it came out differently at that circuit, then you'd have a conflict between the circuits and make it at least ripe for resolution of that conflict before the Supremes.
Exactly. Exactly. That's where it would go. And it would be, and that is exactly the same standard that the Supremes give, right? The Supremes look and they say, and it's funny because there has to be more than a circuit split. There has to be a circuit split on an issue that they believe raises a constitutional question. And so that's why they always do this with the Clean Water Act, right? Because the circuits will be divided as to what the waters of the United States are. And the waters of the United States, that definition, is what determines whether this Clean Water Act applies or it just doesn't. And so there's a big, that's a basic sort of fundamental question that the Supreme Court just loves to weigh in on, right? They love to say, yes, Congress wanted to control this. No, Congress didn't want to control that. And they like to draw those lines. But if it's just the two, courts come to different answers about some sort of detail about how things are implemented in the view of the Supreme Court, if they think it's just a detail, they'll let that go by. They don't care if the circuits disagree on stuff like that. So you got that two thing. You got two prongs. You got to have a disagreement, and they've got to believe it's a disagreement that's a sort of unconstitutional proportion. And I think the same thing's true at en banc, you know, not just that the circuit judges disagree, but they disagree about sort of what the authority of the court is or what the authority of an agency is. That gets to be important enough that they want to clarify that en banc. So I think that's how that goes.
Well, it's a grim future, Scott, that this state faces. It was a grim future before this decision. It is more grim afterward.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I say this every time I call you, but you know, this is exactly why I think that the horn is so important, right? Because this is a long-term project to influence the dialogue. We have to have a place where we can speak and say, no, it doesn't have to be the way that the mass media says it is. Those are not the only choices. You know, let us tell you another way of another frame that you can put on this. And I thought what you did with the was it Tennessee or Kentucky, the coal sludge spill?
Mm-hmm.
Your coverage was the best of anything I heard because it was just honest and direct. It wasn't trying to soft pedal things. It wasn't trying. You know, you could see in the other coverage that, you know, it's like, oh, they called it a leak in one case. A leak? Are you kidding me? Right? They said things like, well, you know, we've got this, you know, millions of gallons of sludge all across the landscape, but it doesn't appear that any humans are going to be hurt. So everything's fine. You just destroyed the whole landscape there. You're never going to make that right.
No.
But that's okay, you know, because you can move people to other areas and they'll probably won't be killed by it, right? And I thought just having a place like the Horn where you could actually hear like just normal, rational people say, wait a minute, you know, this is really bad what happened there. You know, this this same setup is in place all around the country. Now, this is a bad situation. So I think you're right about the sort of long-term view, you know. It's going to be 25 years before we can make an opinion like this one, this Fourth Circuit opinion, appear so repugnant to people that they'll just say, are you guys crazy? Forget it, right? Change the law. Do whatever it takes. But this is just the wrong result. And I think people now, they look at it, well, you know, on the one hand, you know, you've got the coal industry. We've got to have coal and it's energy security and it's blah, 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 right? And I think by continuing to invest in providing media, basically, a media that says, no, it's not just the convenience of people to have cheap electricity. The environment is being destroyed, and people's lives are being destroyed as a consequence. There's a whole section of the country whose economy will never be able to be what it could be because it's being literally people are having their lives ruined. And until you actually have somebody on CNN, you know, where they have the two people sitting side by side.
Right.
One person says, well, you know, on the one hand, and the other person says, well, you know, the guy from the coal industry's got a good point, but, you know, you can't, that's not two sides of the same issue. You know, so I think it's a really important point for us as progressives to want to continue to build and support, the long project of making sure that people like that when Obama comes time to put a Supreme Court justice in there, that he doesn't try to get consensus from the Republicans.
No, exactly. And you know, the right wing has been very, and again, it's another one of these transference issues, Scott. The Republicans accuse the Democrats of doing what they themselves are best at. The Republican, well, you know, he's got a, the Democrats have a litmus test. They want to know how they'll vote on abortion. I mean, we've heard this over and over again. When in fact the people who have the litmus test are the Republicans who will not let a person get advanced to the Supreme Court, who has not at some point in time, waxed poetic, if you will, about the teensy tiny fetuses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, maybe it's time that Democrats started working on some of that of their own.
Yep.
You know, maybe we need judges. Maybe groups need to make sure that judges are only advanced to high positions on the federal bench if they have got some degree of regard for people who actually live where these toxic activities take place. If they have a demonstrated willingness to hold corporate killers to account. And, you know, let them scream, let the right wing scream liberal till they're blue in the face.
Right, right.
Because.
That's your equal protection, right?
Yeah.
When equal protection means you have a judiciary made up of people who understand what fair treatment is.
There you go.
They're not saying what's good for the corporation. They're saying, well, you know, we can't, we're not going to regulate ourselves into a place where the economy doesn't work anymore. Okay, I'll accept that. But we're also not going to be so favorable to that economic idea that we'll favor economy over all other values we have in society. It's just ludicrous. And we need to get some people to say, well, hold on a second, time out. You know, those are not the only concerns. There are basic concerns of fairness. When was the last time you saw that in a legal opinion?
I don't know if I ever have. I honestly don't know if I ever have.
For sure. You know, they only built Yeah, you might see it in a death penalty case, right? Where someone decides whether the punishment is fair, right? Because you know it's so obviously individualized. But
yeah, he needs to die. Yeah,
I think you're right. I mean, I think one of the things that I was that just drove me bananas during the election was, you know, it's my new, you know, Joe the effing plumber thing, right?
Yeah.
How did he become convinced that the Republicans were actually better for him? That took years and decades of work on the part of business interests and the Republicans to get Joe the effing plumber to think that the Republicans were actually better for him than the Democrats.
And it took a lot of work from a lot of different corners. That is, you know, that what you're talking about there, Scott, is that nexus of influence between corporate America and frankly, what we refer to here as the religion industry.
Mm-hmm.
It has to come at you from all sides.
Yep.
I mean, it really what we're talking about is the essentials how would we put this? The essentials of total immersion in propaganda. There is nowhere that you cannot go and not be hit with this propaganda, because even if you've got second thoughts, sooner or later it'll come around and it'll take you out. If you hear, if you know in your heart that screwing over workers is the wrong thing to do, but you go to church and you hear it's what God wants, and you turn on the TV and you hear it's what the economy needs,
right,
then eventually that still small voice in your soul is going to go quiet.
That's true.
Now, the same thing applies to this economic argument in West Virginia. You saw it in this opinion. It's been in oodles of others. Sooner or later, a judge's judgment is subsumed underneath the persistent argument that, well, you'll destroy the economy in West Virginia.
Exactly.
And apparently, like this guy in Richmond and the guy from South Carolina, they have no idea what life on the ground looks like here. They have no idea. They have no idea the depredation and the depravity and the degradation that has been played out on West Virginia for over a century now in the name of an economy. And to this day, we still have never, ever, ever in this state, Scott, felt the touch of prosperity. Never. And so when the coal companies aren't, well, you know, it'll devastate the economy if you shut down mountaintop removal, the only way West Virginia's ever going to have an economy is if we shut down mountain removal.
That's totally true.
Because that's when you can start getting manufacturers in. That's when you can start getting in people who do things as opposed to simply destroy things.
Right.
You know, there's lots of work out there. There could be lots of work out there for these guys that run this heavy machinery on mountaintop removal jobs. But it will never come here as long as that mountaintop removal job exists. Whether it's a plant to make turbines for wind turbines or the motors for them, or a plant to make solar panels or anything that is deemed green, it will not come here as long as mountaintop removal is here. And what's more, the coal industry knows it, Scott. And they're in, realistically, I think you and I both know, and everybody in the Horn audience knows, this is an end game on a chessboard.
Mm-hmm.
And the end game right now is for the coal companies, who, by virtue of the mere existence of mountaintop removal, already are recognizing that West Virginia and Appalachia are way the heck past peak coal. It's an end game whereby they struggle to scrape and grab and gouge and dig out the last pennies of profit that they can from this poor, tormented area, before we can catch up to them and stop them. We are, it literally is. It's an action on a chessboard. It's a queen, it's a rook chasing the king. The only thing is, we're down to nothing but that rook.
Yeah, exactly.
And they've got the whole damn board in front of us.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is, by the time, if the end game goes the way the coal companies want, they will do what coal companies do. They will disappear, never to be seen or heard from again. They will leave a toxic legacy behind them, and it will be, at that point, impossible to create a new green economy in its wake. What they will have effectively concluded their long strategy, which has always been the overall depopulation of the places where the coal is. So nobody lives there. Nobody can complain about what they've done. Nobody can want to go and hunt down a coal executive and, you know, tar and feather him or anything. It'll be just like that Vonnegut quote, here and there was still an inhabited house.
Yep.
And that's a crime, Scott. That's a crime.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be, it's remarkable to remember this, but it used to be that you didn't even see economists on the television, right? I mean, people didn't frame everything in terms of the economy. You know, and then they decided that that's how they were going to frame every issue. They were going to put these economists on there and tell you, like you said, you know, that coal means jobs. The only thing that means jobs in this area, and it would ruin our economy if we took it away. Now, the problem with that is that an actual economist would actually say what you just said, which is, the coal industry is the thing that's stifling an actual economy from occurring in West Virginia.
Really? You think so?
That's what a real economist would say, right? Because what the coal industry is a monopoly, right? It has a monopoly of political power, of political and economic power in the area. And so that disrupts the market. No real market can occur in an area and this is the reason why there are laws against monopolies, right? Because the concentration of power distorts the market. You can't actually have choice when there's only one employer in town. It's unfair. We all understand that. You take West Virginia, and you have this incredible political/economic power in this industry. And it's, you know, if you look at it just from a simple economic sense, like if you weren't one of the players in it, you just stand back from it and you say, what would be more vibrant? It's like a biodiversity argument, right? The economy is like an ecosystem. It's supposed to have competition and sort of ebb and flow.
Dynamic tensions.
Exactly. You know, people, you know, the fittest, you know, people doing farming in the areas that are most productive for farming, and people doing, manufacture in the areas where there's the best infrastructure for transportation and these kinds of things. The system would adjust and would move and be fluid. And then you look at something like West Virginia, where you've got a single footprint of a single industry with as much control as it has over both the economic and political lives of the people in that area. And if you want to be a free marketeer, you have to say, that's not a market. That's a problem that should be fixed. If you believe in markets, you should say, that's a problem because it's not a market. It's unfair. The actors can't freely choose. They can't actually choose a better and more profitable course,
right,
path for them with longer, better long-term prospects. They're not able to do that. And this is what I find so funny about it. What I find so disgusting about it is why I don't mind economics as a discipline. But why is it that every economist has to be such a tool? Right? I mean, an economist can come to that, and we, progressives, could put progressive economists up there to say exactly what I just said. Right? Get on CNN, and you say, what about the economic impact of coal in West Virginia? And you're going to have the one guy that says, well, if you pass these regulations that makes coal harder, it's going to be bad for the economy. And you have another guy get up there and say, well, actually, it will be the best thing for the economy. You never hear that. You never hear someone. You hear when an economist comes up, they have this sort of air of being sort of academic and unbiased, because they're just working with numbers and models and things, right? Couldn't be further from the truth. They go in with the supposition that...
Yeah, they start with a premise. It's like I've said about science in general in the past. If you start with a premise that you are going with the goal of validating your premise as opposed to merely testing it, without a bias.
Proving it. Yeah.
It's not science when you go in and say, and I don't care if it's an economist or a biologist doing it. When you go in and say, I have premise A, and I want to prove it valid. I want to prove that the free market means creating mono economies in extraction states.
Right.
Then it is literally the definition of a foregone conclusion.
Yep.
But there are people out there that are trying to do this work. Beyond Paul Krugman. Dean Baker. Dean Baker does a lot of it.
Yep.
But you never hear...
When you, Sorry.
You never hear it applied to something like this.
You don't hear it enough. There was a really good feature on the media. Do you ever listen to that? It comes out of NPR, WNYC in New York.
I'm familiar with it, but I don't get a strong enough NPR signal to.
Well, they do it as podcasts, and that's how I listen to it, actually.
Oh, wow, okay.
And it's really excellent. It's really good because what it is this is sort of a journalism school analysis and deconstruction of how the media is actually doing and what it's doing. Sort of item by item, story by story. So they have this week's story. And one of the things that they had a really fascinating guy on, talking about this thing that they teach journalism students, which is that you should have two sides to every story. And this happened with, this became, sort of well known in the global warming debate.
Right.
Where every story had a pro global warming or, you know, sort of pro human cause and an anti human cause person in it, as though those two things were equally credible, right?
Right, and you can take that to its logical conclusion, Scott, by saying, let's talk about something much more prosaic. Let's talk about a story about a cat burglar.
Uh-huh.
Would you have a pro-cat burglary portion of the story and a pro-law and order portion? You know, where you're talking about a clear social ill. Is there really room or an opening for, I guess what I'm saying, all journalism is not two-sided.
It's not, and I think the thing that's interesting is the players understand that, right? So what he was talking about in this case was now the big companies have had to basically admit that they lost the political fight over global warming. Now what they're doing is they're playing on the field of what are going to be the economic costs of taking a particular approach to solving global warming. And if you listen to the media, you can hear this now.
Yes, absolutely.
How much is it going to cost? How much is it going to cost, right? Guess who's showing up to give the estimates of the cost? It's all the same guys who are hired by all the same companies who said that global warming wasn't caused by humans or it wasn't even happening.
Yeah, the same kleptocrats.
It's going to devastate the economy, right? Same guys, right? And, you need some balance. And I think the point of the story that was really interesting to me was, used to be the journalists would invest some effort into telling you, like your cat burglar example. They would tell you, the majority opinion is this. And there are people who believe that the cost might be higher than that. But they're actually in the minority, and they're primarily people who are associated with organizations that fight all kinds of regulation, no matter what they are. Right? But what's happening now is that media companies have been gutted to the extent that all they can do, that the journalists themselves are not expert enough to even make that judgment. So they call up two experts, they get two opposite sides, they write the story, give equal attention to both sides, and they move on to something else. You know, the media is, and that's what's so interesting about it, is they're basically saying the media is just so lazy now that they have this simple formula and the same people are gaming the system. They understand. All they have to do is show up and give the guy this big fat economic analysis and they'll say, well, this guy's an expert. And guess what story gets written?
Sure. We've seen it in graphic form, Scott, protests over the Iraq occupation. The media, the CNN, for instance, will go out and say, protesters converged on New York City today to demand an end to the war in Iraq. Supporters of the war in Iraq were also present as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, granted, on the one hand, the anti-war people, you know, there was a million of them, right. And the pro-war people, there were 12.
Exactly.
12, not 12 million, 12.
Yeah.
But CNN or whomever will create this idea that they are equally valid sides of a coin.
Right. Right.
And that's duplicitous, Scott. I think
it's just lazy. I mean, you're right, it's duplicitous, but it's also just lazy. I think in a lot of cases, and you know, CNN aside, I mean, CNN ought to be able to do a better job than that. You know, it's just the thing in your local paper or.
But look what happened. Look what happened here a week or so ago. The local TV, and I ran some of the audio on the program. Local TV, in regard to yet another one of those community hearings that the DEP holds, focused on the presence of a gentleman who is here, who nonviolent, can't be accused of any violence, and they go on air and literally, and they use that same old sick little lazy journalism canard. Some people call him an eco-terrorist.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, if you're a real journalist, aren't you under a duty, Scott, to tell who those some people are? Doesn't that go to the credibility of your reportage? If the some people turns out to be a PR flack from Massey, that creates an entirely different picture. But, you know, some people, you know, some.
And if those allegations don't have anything to do with the facts, right? Here's a person goes out. Peaceful protest, no property damage, no nothing. So what's the relevance of saying the person's an eco-terrorist? It's not related to the story. You know why they do it, but just from a factual matter, you'd say, well, some people call him an eco-terrorist. However, an eco-terrorist is a person who damages property and puts people's lives at risk as a consequence, and that was not the case here. No evidence that that was the case.
Right, and, you know, we don't...
Maybe an extra sentence or two, you know?
Yeah,
you know,
we don't live in a bubble. We know what the word terrorist means. The minute you call someone an eco-terrorist, well, he's probably wearing a green turban.
Yeah. Yeah, it used to be called civil disobedience. You know, now it's terrorism.
You know, maybe he flies hang gliders into buildings.
Yeah, he gets a carbon offset before he does it, yeah. No, that's, it's a bad scene, and I think the, So let me shift gears just a little bit and tell you about what I'm up to.
Oh, please.
I think you'll find it interesting. So what I've decided to do, I've been trying to do something for the environment for a long time and getting pretty darn frustrated about it, as you can tell. And so what I've decided is start an internet project, which is aimed at people like us, your listeners, and lots of people that we all know, people who don't accept as a foregone conclusion that every person is in a race to the bottom to buy as much of the cheapest stuff they could possibly find, no matter what the consequences are. And so you know that there are people in the world, because many of them are listening right now, who actually care about the consequences of what they buy and how they live their lives and the decisions they make, what kind of work they do, and just sort of everything up and down the line. And people like that, like myself, really feel like a minority in our culture. Right? You just continually bombarded with all these messages about, you know, it's all about the economy, it's all about driving to the lowest cost, no matter what.
Yeah, the ghettoization.
Exactly. And there are a lot of people like myself and many of your listeners who just don't accept that as a foregone conclusion. Right, so the purpose of this project is to provide a place where people like us can get together and collaborate to help each other find better, more conscious, more sustainable, whatever words you want to use, more conscious and conscientious choices about pretty much everything you do in your life. What kind of car you drive, you know, what you do with your home, whether you grow your food or not, or where you shop for your food, where you send your kids to school, how you get to work, all of these things, what you do when you're at work, all of this stuff, right? And the idea is to basically create, we have sort of a neat new interface for allowing people to share these ideas, where if I do a project and I'm looking at doing container gardening so I can actually grow some food in my urban environment in the backyard, and I do all that research and I find sort of the neatest solutions for that and tips and tricks, I can sort of build that into this interface, into this collaboration space, for other people to see when they come later to that same topic. Someone says, oh, yeah, you know, I've always wanted to do that. I wonder what the good solutions are for that. Rather than having to start the search over from the beginning, you actually go in, you go into this this visual environment, and the metaphor is called Make the Path. And it's basically, it's based on the Antonio Machado poem that says, "Pathwalker, there is no path. You must make the path by walking."
Ooh.
And I feel about that way about us, being the people that listen to this show. You know, part of it is we can expect our elected representatives to make some changes for us. But part of us is we have to recognize as actors, we have a big voice as to what companies get rewarded, what kinds of things get done, and what kinds of things don't get done, what things are acceptable and what things aren't. And we can help each other. The problem is we're all so isolated now. We can help each other by coming together and saying, yeah, you know, I want to try to do my best. I'm not going to go, you know, go crazy about it, but I want to try to do my best. And those things that I found that I think are really, you know, good companies that really care about their employees and make a good product and don't screw the environment and whatever, I want to share those with people. And when, you know, you maybe become an expert in studying up how to do, like, ride sharing or something, how to get to and from work without having to buy a second car. And so you do that research. And you drop that on the site. And everyone has their own thing, and they all start to build out these paths, so sort of the make the path to the kind of economy we wish existed. And so you can go into the site, and what you've got is the site's, these paths are populated by people like us who said, you know, I found these people. I think they're good. You know, for this thing, here's what I do. Here's what I do with my rainwater. Here's what I do with composting. Here's what I did with my, I had to do some renovations for the house. You know, here's where I got my building materials because they're actually made with sustainable lumber or whatever the deal is.
Or I compared these, you know, these various suppliers and found this one to be the greenest. Right, sure.
Exactly. And so you put that knowledge there to share with the community. It's not like a blog. It doesn't have lots of words where people are saying, well, you know, on the one hand, but on the other hand, you know, it's very visual. You know, you find stuff you like, you drop it into the environment. Other people can sort of, you know, they navigate around. It's almost like a virtual environment, like a gaming environment.
This is a brilliant idea. What makes me think that your lovely wife has probably had a hand in this conceptualization?
Well, so yes, absolutely. So one of the things that she brings to it, I think is really important, is it's not just about stuff. It's not living your life is not just about stuff. It's about us coming up with other forms of wealth, you know, creativity, right?
Literally a wealth of knowledge.
Yeah, or, you know, local community, connecting with your local community, going to performances, you know, learning to play an instrument. You know, there's all kinds of things that you can do that don't require you to buy anything, but that contribute to your sense of sort of well-being and richness, of the richness of your experience, how enjoyable your life is. And so one of the parts of this is to have people build paths that basically tell their personal story. Here are the things I care about. These are the things I like. I like hiking. And I go hiking, and it makes me want to protect these areas. Because if they're lost, we're going to lose something that we're never going to get back. And we will be poorer because of it. It's a form of wealth. Doesn't mean I have to buy anything. It just means I can go and experience it. So, yeah, creativity. People actually writing or painting or doing photography or playing music or whatever it is you do to express yourself is an important part of wealth, of living a rich life. And having people, again, have an environment where they're like, yeah, I didn't know that was available. This is great. You know, there's a great festival going on down here, or the museum is open for free on Thursdays, or, you know, our new thing is we love our library. Public library is like one of the coolest things in town.
Yeah.
Right? To learn about that, you know. Learn about taking advantage of resources that, you know, we've invested in as a community and really living, you know, taking advantage of those and actually supporting them. Then you get a bunch of people who say, what do you mean you want to shut down the library? Are you nuts? Right? The library makes me feel like a wealthy person. There's all kinds of cool stuff in the library.
Yes.
Whatever it is your gig is, you know. So that's the idea. And I'm hoping, working on the prototype right now, And I'm hoping that when we get a little further along, we can recruit some of the horn users to be our alpha and beta testers and take the thing for a ride. And,
oh, golly, yeah, I'm sure people will, and we will link to it on the network site immediately. Do you have any idea how far away you are from alpha and beta?
We'll probably do alpha in another couple few months, maybe 3 months, and then we'll begin a beta probably. Maybe 3 months after that, so maybe 6 months away from a broader beta. I'd love to get some people in on an alpha, not expecting, you know, if people who understand where we're at, right? We just need some people to bust it and tell us how they, you know, tell us what happened when it broke, you know.
Yeah, the computer equivalent of getting to work for a toy company and pretending to be a three-year-old.
Exactly. But the other thing we need to do is we want to get people on there to start telling their story, you know, put some cool stuff on the site that they want to share with other people, that they wish other people knew about. And then browsing around the site and go, hey, that's pretty cool. I didn't know about that. You know, really start sharing. You know, start to build a community of people who actually care where their stuff comes from and care about the consequences of it and care about how they live their lives. So, yeah, we're thinking, you know, a few months out for the sort of people who are willing to be a little more of the pioneering spirit, as we said earlier, and 6 months out to do a bigger rollout. One of the things that's on the site already is a path for media, because media is important, right? Where you get your information is really important. And we want to build a path there where people say, where do I get my information from? And the horn is already on the path. Of course, you know, there's nobody, you know, there's only a couple people using the thing right now. But that's the kind of thing we want to be able to do. We want people to say, here's where I go to get my information. Here, you know, here's where like sane people talk about things. And then you can come. The other thing we want to do with this is essentially, no idea like this starts small, right? You can either change the world, right? We want to create an economy. We want to create a parallel economy. We want to tell people, look, you know, you don't always have to go for the cheapest, piece of junk thing. You don't always have to go with the financial services company that's going to go belly up because they're looking for an extra percentage return on something. You know, we can go with local banking. We can go with local businesses. We can actually create a healthy economy. If you guys want to do your sort of laissez-faire capitalism, whatever, you know, go ahead. But it doesn't mean we have to buy into that. We can have a place where we can sort of be economic actors and reward the kind of businesses that will sponsor the horn, as an example, because they know the horn has listeners that care about the kind of products they make. And they're not afraid, you know, they're not afraid that they're going to say, oh, geez, I don't know. I mean, they're not pro-business enough for me. This is a pro-business environment. If you're a business that doesn't suck, we want you to do really well.
How perfect.
And you want to be with us. Because we are your customers, right? I mean, let's use the market, fine, but let's not just be a bunch of, you know,
sheep.
Yeah, or even worse, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
automatons.
Let's not be Joe the plumber, you know, where we become convinced that we have to put up, we just have to live in a world where, you know, the products that come to us, who the heck knows what's in them, and who the heck knows who was oppressed in their making, and who the heck knows what. What? How many mountaintops had to be removed? Don't even tell me about that, right? Keep that invisible for me. Consumers, you know, I'll just leave you with this piece, too. So we started doing this, right? We started build the site, really, because I want a place like this to exist. I want to be able to share ideas with people and get all their cool ideas and start living this way. So we do the market research, right? Because someone, of course, is going to ask you, how big is this market? Turns out that people who feel this way, adults in America, between 15 and 25 million people.
Wow.
Who actually say they would actively seek out products and services that were more considerate of the consequences of their production, both from environmental and human rights and humanistic standpoints, labor and those sorts of things. And they'd actually seek them out and they'd actually pay more for them if they knew that they were actually more consonant with their own beliefs. Now, I was flabbergasted by that number because
that's stunning.
I can't imagine there's that many people like this. And the reason for that, there's some research that goes into this. The reason for that is that people like us look at the broader media and they don't see our values reflected at all. And so you think you're in a tiny minority you think, geez, I must be some kind of wacko tree hugger or something, right? In fact, there's, you know, between 15 and 25 million people in this country, adults in this country, that are sort of thinking this way and wish it weren't the way that it is. And you can only imagine how many people in India and how many people in China are going to come to the very same conclusion when they start to do to their environment what we've done to ours here. Now, this is the big idea, right? The big idea is let's just create our own economy. Rather than waiting for someone to make the broader economy the way we want it to be, let's just get together and create a place where we can help each other construct an economy of people and businesses and so forth working together, not against each other, to create the kind of economy that people like us wish existed. Seems simple enough. So that's the big idea.
Well, that's the way it always works, Scott. The concept is simple. The execution is the booger. But
oh yeah.
but you've got a working visual and functional metaphor. This path metaphor. I'm seeing it in my head, and I'm sure it will look differently than the way you saw it in your head. But I can't wait to see it, because this is going to be. This is the kind of an effort toward, you know, I used the word ghetto earlier, breaking out of the corporate ghetto.
Right.
Because it starts with, you know, you're not a person, you're a consumer.
Exactly.
It goes, and from there, you know, once a person has been divorced from his or her humanity, then it's okay, then, you know, you're just a consumer, so you don't have to worry about the kid, the Vietnamese kid chained to the table for 12 hours a day, gluing tennis shoes together, for instance.
Yep, that's right. It's dehumanizing.
Yes, for clarity's sake, on both ends of the transaction.
Yep. Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Well, I can't wait. I can't wait to hear more about this, Scott. And I hope that you'll keep us posted on it. We don't talk nearly often enough, but when we do, you certainly get a lot of quality into the conversation.
Yeah. Well, you know, I hate to say, I've been busy, but you know, I left the firm a few months ago, and I've been sort of full bore on this thing. But we listen to the show all the time, so I don't, you know. I want you to know that there's a lot of us that really get an awful lot out of the program, even if we're not calling. But I think that with this, I'm really looking forward to getting some people from the Horn audience. You know, many people I think have a lot of interesting knowledge that they could share. I mean, the purpose of this thing is it's a proactive thing. You're not a passive consumer of information. We are making the path. We, all of us, are making the path. We engage in a sort of a group project, and I know that's the kind of listener that you have. You know, the kind of people that want to do something. Just they're so sick of it. You know, they want to do something. So I'm really looking forward to being able to, you know, sort of engage that community in that way.
Well, when you give the word, Scott, I think you'll have the people.
All right. Now I'm looking forward to it, you know, with this, I think it feeds into this Fourth Circuit decision thing. You know, just sometimes you just get so frustrated, you know. You just wish you could do something. And after a while, it just gets, you know, you're just like, what am I going to do? I mean, how do you ever win in an environment like this?
I know. And, you know, you've taken me to another place, and I don't want to keep you too much longer. But you, you know, in a way, you're in what you've just described, though, references a totally different sector. And that is when Proposition 8 went down in California.
Yep.
While I'm not part of the gay community, I recognize that the people who did what they did to the gay community in California won't stop at that. You know, they'll persist because ultimately they want to control everyone's rights, and the gay community was a soft target, if you will. And part of my thinking out of that was, you know, there should be a way of reversing those hateful people's discrimination. And toward that end, what I was thinking is, you know, at what point in time, and I was thinking more on a more personal level, but you've just opened a door here. You know, somebody comes in and wants, you know, you're a dentist and they want their teeth filled, and you look at them as the dentist and say, how did you vote on 8?
Right.
And they say, well, I voted for it. I'm sorry, I can't fill your teeth.
Yeah.
And I guess that's sort of the negative version of what you're talking about. But making sure that we have a full recognition that our consumer choices, our ethical choices, our moral choices.
Right on.
And that we do business at the same time that we do ethics and morals.
And that we're actually, I hate the word consumers. And I let's make this a horn project. Could we please come up with another word? I would love it if we could come up with another word. But as economic actors, which is not nearly sexy enough, we are powerful.
Yeah, choosers.
What?
You know, just free forming as choosers.
What made McDonald's switch from styrofoam to paper? It wasn't the federal government. It wasn't the shareholder action. It was a bunch of consumers, a bunch of people's customers said, look, we're your customers. We don't like the fact that to make hamburgers for us, you produce billions of pounds of styrofoam. And McDonald's got right on it.
Well, and let me give you a more another and more recent example of that. It is tiny. Scott, it's tiny, but I started paying attention to high fructose corn syrup back when paying attention to high fructose corn syrup wasn't cool. Not that
you
it is.
You go into the supermarket and you read, right?
Oh, yeah. Bad.
I do the same thing. Linda makes so much fun of me. It's hilarious. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, we don't have all night for you to read. Yeah, no, believe me. I've gotten the speech.
You won't believe what's in here. No, just read this. It's unbelievable.
Oh, I remember the night that I found out that Pizza Hut's mozzarella cheese is sprayed with silicone. We haven't been to Pizza Hut since, Scott.
Yep.
You know, because I don't know where that thing's going to migrate, and I can't afford the lingerie.
Yeah, really, the whole new line from Victoria's Secret.
Yeah, but anyway, no, a little example of that kind of noisemaking. After my health crisis last May,
yeah,
I started trying to pay attention. Now, I'm back to do some of my bad habits, but I'm still not mainlining the cheese dip. So, you know, we're taking that as a good thing. But I started paying a lot more attention to things like high fructose corn syrup because I got told I was pre-diabetic.
Yep.
Well, I don't drink pop anymore.
Yeah.
And I avoid high fructose corn syrup like the plague. Guess what? I'm not pre-diabetic that anymore.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
So in the grocery, I drink juices. I drink a lot of grape juice. I drink cranberry juice. I drink apple juice. And one of the things that I love, oh, heaven help me, I love it, is that ruby red stuff.
Uh-huh.
So I'm in the grocery store the other day, and I see the Kroger brand sitting next to the name brand, which is Ocean Spray.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, I pick up the Kroger brand, and there it is, high fructose corn syrup. Damn it. Oh, you should have heard the swearing that went down when I found out there was high fructose corn syrup in Clamato, for God's sakes. Clamato.
Jesus.
But then, for a buck and a quarter extra, sitting next to the Kroger brand is the Ocean Spray brand, and up in the corner of the label, Scott, is this little dot that says, no high fructose corn syrup.
Uh-huh.
Now,
yep.
You know what? I'll pay the extra buck and a quarter not to have the high fructose corn syrup.
Yep.
And that dot is on that label for a reason.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
A lot of people have gotten in touch with Ocean Spray and said it is not necessary for a pink grapefruit to have high fructose corn syrup in it.
Right.
And I expect one of these days I'll pick up a bottle of Clamato and it'll say no high fructose corn syrup. I know this because the high fructose corn syrup industry is spending money on ads on CNN. Have you seen the popsicle ad?
Have you seen those ads? They are unbelievable. They're actually, I mean, someone should get in touch with the Federal Trade Commission about that because some of the things they say, it's just factually wrong, just flatly incorrect. You know, they say that
lying.
The high fructose corn syrup is nutritionally the same as regular as any other sugar. That's just not true.
No, it's not. Not even a little bit. I mean, I guess it's the same to the extent that, you know, if you put it on your tongue, it tastes sweet, but so does antifreeze.
Yeah. I mean,
but that little dot is on that label now because of consumer action. Because corporations never act out of any sense. And I mean, this isn't me being, you know, I'm not being nasty. It's just, you know, it's the reality. There is no corporate charter that says that the corporation's board of directors or officers have a duty to act morally.
Right.
They have a duty under the structure that we have in this country to act in the best interest of the shareholders. Now, how one colors that is sort of it comes back to the way you described a higher court reviewing the actions of a lower court. It depends. It's all outcome generated.
Yep.
But, you know, Ocean Spray did not do that because one day the CEO went to work and said, you know, I want the high fructose corn syrup out of the Ruby Red.
Right. It would be a good idea. They didn't come up with that on their own. No question about it.
So, you know, what you're describing, Scott, is a model that can work, is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, so you get to if we can get together as a group of activist consumers and start to really push some of that out there, you'll be able to go to the supermarket, you'll be able to go down the aisle, you won't have any trouble figuring out what to buy, right? Because they'll be trying to explain to you why their product is better, right? They'll have the little dot up there, right? Because they'll know. We'll tell them. You make the thing without high fructose corn syrup, and we will buy it. Simple. You know, we're not gonna pick it in front of you, in front of your corporate headquarters if you don't. We're just not gonna buy your stuff. You know, have a nice.
Yeah, look at the peanut industry.
Oh God. Yeah.
Northwestern Airlines got in trouble for serving peanuts. I mean, and it wasn't, you know, the FCC, the FAA or anything. It was people getting in touch with Northwest Airlines and saying, you know, you really want to be doing this?
Yeah.
So, you know, that, and if there's a coordinated way to take people of enlightened goodwill and giving them the empowering tools to do that, which is what I think you're describing, Scott.
That's the idea.
Not within a greed framework, but the sky's the limit. And I gotta tell you before we wrap things up, I have said before that the listeners to this program, you know, you said I may not know what the program's doing for folks who may not necessarily call in. But I hear things from the folks who share their time with this network and this program. And I have this laundry list of behavior that I have modified.
Uh-huh.
Because of what I know is going on during the show. In other I have the Scott and Linda standard. I try not to do it because I know you've told me that y'all listen to the show while you're doing dinner.
That's right, yeah.
I try not to do the gross stuff until dinner's over.
We truly appreciate it. Yeah.
You know, that's
sickening, but
yeah. Because of other people I know that have little children, I try to do, you know, 20 minutes worth of riff on Bob's going to use a dirty word in a minute so that they can be hustled out of the room.
Right.
I have, and this is on a sadder level, there are people who have been touched by certain forms of tragedy that I have indirectly referenced in a lighthearted way who have said, you know, you may mean it humorously, but every time you say it, it hurts me.
Uh-huh.
It's gone.
That's interesting, yeah.
So there's a way to be, and it's the same thing you're describing. There is a way to be cognizant of that universe of ideas around us, and that universe of ideas is populated by people, not consumers.
Right.
People.
Right.
And if we will start with just the most de minimis level of comprehension of that, things get better, not worse.
Yeah, they get a lot better. You know, just understanding. I mean, nobody who's listening to this, except maybe the government, would disagree with this. That when you actually appreciate that you're connected to other people, like with what you do, that you're actually connected to all of your listeners. You know, it's again, it's another one of those forms of wealth. It's actually very, it's a very nice way to live, you know, as opposed to I'm a cog in a machine. I'm completely separated from everybody else in society, blah, blah. You know, it's a whole different way of imagining yourself. And like we were saying with the, you know, sort of rabid consumerist capitalist society, it's just fundamentally dehumanizing. And I think that we, you know, people like us and your listeners, you know, we know that's wrong. We just know it intuitively.
Yeah.
Because when we connect with each other, it feels completely different, and it feels much richer and much more, what's the word? I was going to say valuable, but it's not what I mean.
Enriching is where I, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's deep and satisfying, you know, it's calming. It's all of those things, you know, it's anxiety producing to believe that you're a lone person out there rabidly competing for the highest paying job and the lowest cost goods. Well, that's sick, you know. That's not how I imagine myself as a human being.
No, it's not. And
you live like that. You live like that, and guess what you do? You buy your electricity for a company that cuts off the tops of mountains. It's
there you go.
It's not an acceptable bargain. It's just not acceptable.
Well, Scott, I tell you, this has been a magnificent conversation. And I really appreciate everything. Thank you for the legal analysis. Thank you for extrapolating it over into other parts of our existence. Because that way change comes. The real stuff.
Yep.
Because
that's what we're doing here, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because you know the decision. While he may have thought, what was his name, Roger Goodwin or something, I don't remember.
Yeah.
The Fourth Circuit judge in Richmond. He was just going to work.
Yeah.
And his work involves doing corporate bidding. And he was doing results-based legal analysis. That opinion was probably not written by him, but somebody who's, you know, a year out of law school.
Yeah.
And it's just another day on the job. But when you take a decision like that and you subject it to the analysis that you and I have, and you extrapolate it out into the real world, the real meaning of it becomes abundantly clear.
Right.
And so I appreciate that very, very much. And I hope your dinner didn't get cold.
No, I'm sure it didn't. You know, there's a lot that we've wanted to share, and we've enjoyed being on the listening side. And I'm going to get people engaged in this project because, you know, I think we're in this thing together, right? We're working on something together, and, you know, so I want to contribute as much as I can. Well, I am going to go have my dinner now.
And bon appetit to you and your lovely wife.
Leave it over to your next callers and other people in the horn audience.
All right. Well, thanks, Scott. And
you, Bob.
Don't be a stranger. You know the new email address. The other one died, you know.
Yeah.
So shoot in an idea anytime.
All right. Great.
Take care. Bye now.
All right. You have a good one. Bye now.
We don't hear from Scott in Salem, Mass. Very often, but he packs a lot of information to it when he does. Let's keep things rolling along here. Hey, welcome to the program.
It's Richard, Bob.
Hey, Richard, how you doing?
Oh, fair to middling, struggling along, and fixing turntables to keep the wolf from the door.
You know, that may actually be a little bit of a growth industry. There's a lot of people
right.
who are recognizing the validity of vinyl.
Oh yeah, even before that, we had 93 companies in the world making turntables. Believe it or not, what we don't have is people making cartridges and needles. We're not very well supplied with that.
So are you rehabbing those too?
Well, actually, there are some. I am restoring and tweaking some cartridges that go back to 1948. You know, it's really interesting.
There really was a golden age for that kind of stuff.
Well, certainly when, you know, 1948 is when the LP hit the market. And that changed a lot of the recording, you know, a lot of music, frankly.
You know, I can remember as a child having turntables that still had 16 on them.
Oh, hell. That was a standard feature. Now, just go out and find a record that plays at 16.
We had some of them. I don't know what became of them, but we did.
Yeah, what'd you have?
Oh, I can't. I 1920s stuff and 30s stuff.
Really? That's fascinating, because I myself...
And they were as thick as dinnerware.
At 16, geez, those were usually 78s, as I remember.
Maybe I'm bass ackwards, but I do remember the 16 setting.
Yeah, it came about, now I'm going to be wrong when I talk about this, but around sometime in the late 50s, I think, commercial 16 RPM 12-inch records were put on the market. You know, the advertisement was that you could put twice as much music on a record, which is true. The fidelity was terrible. I used to cut them. I worked among the many interesting things I've done in my life, I was a recording engineer for Recording for the Blind, a record cutting engineer. And we made talking books at 16 2/3.
And oh, wow.
Horrendous.
Well, there's another thing we share in common, Richard. Once upon a time, I was a reader of books for visually impaired people.
Yeah, well, that's it. We got tapes in from people, volunteer readers from all over.
Well, that was my work study in college for a time.
Far out. Yeah, actually, a lot of people with Southern accents used to record those tapes that I cut from. I wasn't the only person doing it. I mean, you know, there was a whole crew of recording people, because we used to cut the records to order.
Oh, wow.
And... some of the machines that I work on have 16 speed on them, but honestly, I have to say, I have never with my own eyes seen any 16 2/3 RPM records other than the ones that I cut. But I've been told, you know, I'm involved on this turntable bulletin board that's dedicated to Lenco turntables, which was... moderate selling brand of turntables from Switzerland and Italy. And I mentioned, that 16 2/3 was only used by one record company, and a lot of people corrected me. Vox Records, that was the label that recorded classical on it.
Okay. I'm getting a note in here from Ben Birch, who knows a lot about a lot of things, that 16 was the U.S. Army format for transcriptions and also used with language courses.
Oh, okay. See? I didn't know that either.
It's the beauty of the horn, Richard.
What's that?
It's the beauty of the horn.
The beauty of the horn is that I'm not the smartest person in the room, and that is, you know, that's really a pleasure.
Well, I know I'm not. Ben may be. I mean...
Oh, Ben's very smart guy. Yeah, I know.
In the chat room, Lottie is just astonishing.
Oh, yeah.
In the depth of his knowledge.
I do know that. And actually, I had a B in my bonnet that I called about. Two Bs, three Bs. And you touched on it in the previous conversation, which had to do with strange ingredients in food.
Okay.
And I am looking at a box of Health Valley cereal.
Right? Well, if it's called Health Valley, it's got to be good for you, Richard.
Yeah, and it is a division of the Hain Corporation, which...
No, I remember cold-pressed oils, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that outfit, right. You know, but they got... what I remember was they always charge more for everything than anybody else in the...
Right, and you could, if I recall my back in the day correctly, you could only buy it at your local health food store.
Correct. Now, let me read to you what it says on this, in the ingredients in this, or in this box of Rice Crunchems cereal.
Mm-mm.
Mm-mm. The first ingredient is milled rice. What's that a euphemism for?
Milled rice. Processed rice?
You bet. It's white rice.
Yeah. Without the, yeah, with the nutrient-laden, nutrient-rich husk removed.
That's right. Next ingredient is corn bran. That's okay. Next ingredient is evaporated cane juice.
That's sugar.
Exactly.
Jesus God, that's...
I do not appreciate that.
That's cheating.
Oh yeah.
But then again, the greenwashing of so-called organics is at an epidemic level.
Right. Well, this evaporated cane juice thing's been sticking in my craw for over 2 years now, and I'm seeing it in, you know, Trader Joe products, and you know, that bugs me because Trader Joe is, you know, they've been a better outfit in general. So anyway, if
well, maybe it's a, maybe it's not sugar in their world until the evaporated cane juice is subjected to the bleaching process. I mean, it's like, you know, one of the things that you learn as a you know, when you fool around in the kitchen is that, for instance, well, I had to explain it to my son one day. He thought brown sugar was sugar that was not as processed as the white sugar. Until I explained to him that the brown sugar is white sugar that has had molasses added back to it.
Yeah, what I had heard was something similar to that, that the brown came from the rust in the pipes in the processing plant.
No, it's simply a matter of adding molasses back into the white sugar.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'll have to check that out. There's a sugar plant not far from me, the C&H factory. And I love the town that it's in. It's an old, what do we call it, real blue-collar town in Crockett, California. And I love walking there. We've got some WPA projects. The place looks, it looks like a factory town from the mountains of Pennsylvania. Really nice.
Oh, wow.
And so I go walking there a lot. I'll have to check that out about that. About the brown sugar. But if anybody wants to call up the Hain Corporation and give them a piece of your mind, can I give out the phone number?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, it's 800-434-4246.
And this is Health Valley Rice Tasties?
Rice Crunch-ems.
Crunch-ems. Rice Crunch-ems.
Yeah, Crunch-ems. 800-434-4246. And tell them all about it tomorrow. And
okay, the next bee under your bonnet is?
Yeah. Oh, okay. The Proposition 8 donor list. Now, have you heard about that?
Yes, I have.
You know, in the...
Oh, the haters protested loud and long at the idea that their donations would be made public and they would be shown for the monsters that they are.
Yeah, well, I decided I would take a look at the donor list. And, you know, California is a very complex place.
To say the very least, absolutely.
We got a lot of people here, and we got Republicans who are Democrats, and Democrats who are Republicans, and, you know, a lot of weird stuff. But we have some kind of good honesty in politics sorts of things. You know, like if I came on your program and I talked about how I'm a health commissioner, I have to say I'm not speaking for my commission, but I'm speaking as a private individual.
Right.
You know, there are certain things that I have to be very, very clear about. I actually took a couple of classes in it just to be, you know, how you're expected to be honest. And, I took a look at this donor list that's on the web. Anybody is free to take a look at it, you know. Just Google onto California Secretary of State and just plow in there. It'd be like two clicks and you're in. And it was an amazing list. I mean, it lists everybody, you know, like donations down to $20, $10 are on there, and who it was. And it's like, it's just mind-boggling. There's about 65 pages of donors. And I just looked like one and got blown away. Well, here's who's on it. You got multiple donations from Focus on the Family.
Sure.
So we'll start with that. I didn't see.
And they're, you know, Focus on the Family, Mormon Church, Roman Catholic Diocese, those are sort of the usual suspects.
Well, I didn't even get to those second ones you mentioned, but there was, then there was a front, some kind of a front outfit with somebody's name on it in Southern California. And, you know, there were these multiple donations for like $100,000, $100,000, $100,000. So it would be quite a job to plow through this because you probably have about 40 donors on each page.
Wow. And, but, you know, that's the thing. It's sorting out those businesses. The people that decent people ought not be doing business with, Richard.
Well, fine. Yeah. No, I agree. But the thing is that a lot of them are hiding behind fronts. I mean, you don't know, like who the Tom Jones Foundation is, you know, or Tom Jones and Associates. It's that sort of thing. Okay, so anyway, yeah, everybody's welcome to go take a list and hate away. My final bee in my bonnet is an outfit called Restore Hetch Hetchy.
Restore Hetch Hetchy?
Restore Hetch Hetchy. Hetch Hetchy is the name of a dam inside Yosemite National Park. It's owned by the city of San Francisco. And it was a favorite hiking spot for John Muir. And he was heartbroken when this valley was given over to the city of San Francisco to dam. And the Sierra Club, I have a feeling the Sierra Club was founded on, you know, on that.
Yeah, because the Sierra Club goes back to what, 1894?
I don't know, but the dam was apparently... They started messing around with that idea around 1903, so it actually predates the earthquake in 1906. But
well, the Sierra Club is 1894, so yeah.
Ah, okay. The you know, there were two things that happened in, as far as the earthquake was concerned. And first of all, the earthquake didn't even happen in San Francisco. It was epicentered about 90 miles up north in Santa Rosa. So you can imagine the kind of force that that thing had. But the second thing that happened, the real tragedy, was the fire. And they just didn't have the water to put out the fires. So on the heels of that, the water was coming from a private water company. San Francisco embarked on this enormous project and was officially given title to the Hetch Hetchy Valley, which I am, you know, is reputed to be as beautiful as the Yosemite Valley. So the city built a staging area, which is now a public family camp owned by the city, and I've stayed there and I've studied the project a little bit. These people want to knock down the dam. And this is like our liberal firing, circular firing squad. You know what I mean? The reason being that this dam supplies water to a number of cities, and not just San Francisco, but a whole bunch of cities around the Bay Area and other places as well. And it's also an electricity generating dam. And it's a beautiful project. The water, for instance, is delivered without the consumption of any power. The system is a siphon. So there's a couple of diesel pumps that get the stream flowing. And then in two pipes, it actually goes over two mountain ranges. All by itself.
Just by force of pumps on one end, gravity on the other?
Well, the pump, you know, like any siphon, you have to start it moving. You have to start
Okay, yeah. Okay, that's okay. Yeah, where you get the mouthful of gasoline, sure.
Yeah, once the pumps get the water moving, they cut out. They shut down. The water just keeps going. So, I mean, this is what people in the engineering world call elegant. It's just very, very sweet. Everybody else pumps water to get it from the mountains to where it's going.
Well, and in a way, that's it's reminiscent. All older water delivery projects function, in essence, with some degree of the technology that was pioneered by the Romans.
Did they have siphons?
Well, it's not really so much of a siphon as much as it is...
the aqueduct.
Yeah, once you get it going downhill, you engineer the downhillness of it.
Yeah.
Interestingly, there's little attention paid to it, but it was also a known and functioning technology in the New World. The Mexica people that we call the Aztecs had an elaborate system of aqueducts around their capital where Mexico City now stands.
Wow. Now, see, that's impressive. The Arabs did, too. You know, they were very good at this, and, you know, back before Jesus, I think. But so I'm looking at this map of this. I mean, this project is just mind-boggling. Electricity, lots of electricity comes out of... Actually, it's a network of three dams. There's a second smaller dam in Yosemite, and then there's a third dam, which is just outside it in the National Forest. And there are holding reservoirs. So the thing is that all this electricity is free. You know, there's no hydrocarbons burned. There's no global warming coming from the generation of it.
It is green. Yeah, it's green on that end. The problem, though, Richard, is the... With global climate catastrophe and global climate change being what it is, all that, you know, that damming of that water is it's a function of glacial runoff and stream collection, is it not?
Glacial runoff?
Or not? I mean, you know, snow melt.
Yeah, it is. By the way, we are having a series of storms around here, so my drought is finally, I think it's finally over. We've been on water rationing in the East Bay.
Well, among other things, I was reading something today where James Hansen, the scientist who has been the most noisy, if you will, who has been sounding the alarm most loudly about global warming, climate-based catastrophe, pointed out that at present levels, there will be no snow melt to fill reservoirs in less than 50 years.
That is really scary. I don't, what in the world can we all do about it, aside from keeping Republicans out of office?
There's a transcript called The Sword of Damocles over at columbia.edu. He says changes are beginning to appear, and there is a potential for explosive changes with effects that would be irreversible if we do not rapidly slow fossil fuel emissions over the next few decades.
He points out
that tipping points are fed by what he calls amplifying feedbacks. In other words, input and what comes back as a result of the input. Well, you know, geez, I'm talking to a guy who works on record players. Amplified feedback.
How is he using the term? That's what I...
Well, he says, as Arctic sea ice melts, the darker ocean absorbs more sunlight and speeds melting. As tundra melts, methane, a strong greenhouse gas, is released, causing more warming. As species are pressured and exterminated by shifting climate zones, ecosystems can collapse, destroying more species.
Yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. Well, my point is that I think that we've got to use everything at our disposal that isn't harmful or that already exists to avoid as much carbon being burned as we possibly can. And these guys want to tear down this dam.
What Hansen goes to, Richard, is he points out, for instance, as I noted, practically every glacier on Earth could be gone within 50 years, and he predicates this on the concept that if carbon dioxide continues to increase at current rates, okay?
Yes.
Now, the current rate of carbon dioxide growth, he notes that the pre-industrial carbon dioxide amount was 280 parts per million. Humans, by burning coal, oil, and gas, have increased carbon dioxide to 385 parts per million. That's in a, you know, that's in 150 years' time. And it grows by 2 parts per million per year. 2 parts per million per year. Predicating what he says on that 2 parts per million per year growth, that's what gives you the melt-off of every glacier on the planet.
Jeez. So what do we do about it?
Well, what, you know, what he is trying to do is to get people to get serious. You know, we talk about, because at the heart, for instance, and this goes to something that Scott was saying earlier, at the heart of, for instance, the carbon capture discussion, which is just pure lunacy.
Yeah, it is. I agree.
That thing is grounded in the idea that if we figure out how to store the carbon, we can burn all of it we want.
Oh, no. No way.
You know, this is all, and there are people in the audience who have far more experience than I, because mine is academic, far more experience than I with dealing with addictive processes.
Yeah.
And that is classic addictive process thinking, if I understand correctly. In other words, if I take care of the rest of my health, I can keep running heroin up my arm.
Yeah.
Or if I just go out and run 6 miles every day, I can drink a case of beer every night. But it never works out that way, because the individual systems that you're damaging by your addict conduct do not, you know, they don't exist in a vacuum. So that running those 6 miles or, you know, eating vulgar wheat doesn't keep the addictive substance from harming you. And the same thing applies to carbon. You know, we can't, you know, West Virginia, for instance, the environmental folks here, and I'm still troubled by that word.
Yeah, right.
Yes, I am by definition an environmentalist, but I wonder to what degree that word was imposed upon us by forces opposed to us. Because
that's a good point.
That, you know, that sends us off to the ghetto again.
Yeah.
Because if we, oh, well, you know, they're environmentalists. They only care about little fishies and, you know, creeping little bugs and trees. You know, tree hugger. When in fact we're talking about the fundamental ability, Richard, of the entire human species to continue to exist on planet Earth. You know, that's not an environmentalist. That is a humanist.
Okay, I love it.
So with that in mind, so I'm an environmentalist, and environmentalists in West Virginia, for instance, have proposed what many environmentalists are proposing in their several states, and that is, to wit, a so-called renewable energy portfolio for state government. And, you know, ours was nothing radical. It wasn't, you know, stop burning coal tomorrow, because we can't. You know, cold turkey is tough, even if you can pull it off. So that's not in there, but, it 25 by 25 is one of those phrases that's out there. 25% renewable energy sources by 2025.
Okay, let me take that in. What was that again?
25 by 25 or 15 by 25. You know what our governor came up with? 10 by 25.
Well, you got
10.
You got that special breed of West Virginia corruption.
Oh, but wait, we're not done, Richard. It's 10 by 25. But within the 10 is clean coal technology.
Oh.
In other words, we're going to call it dehydrated cane juice instead of sugar.
Yes, that's good.
But it's still sugar.
Yeah.
We're not going to call it dirty coal. We're going to call it carbon neutral coal. But it's still going to make the damn glaciers melt.
Well, let me ask you a question. Are there any broken down small hydropower dams in your area? that can be, you know, rebuilt? Do you know of any?
No. In fact, the one of the great debates is whether or not to dam the Greenbrier River, because the Greenbrier River is a notorious flood source. Every now and then it gets out of its banks and it wreaks real havoc. And then people come in, we need a dam on the Greenbrier River. And the other side says, like hell we do. You need to move off the damn floodplain.
What's yeah. your opinion?
Move off the floodplain.
Yeah. And what? And dam it?
No. Leave it alone.
Leave it alone. I went to school in Connecticut. I mean, that's where my degrees are from, University of Connecticut. And I, so I drive around this rural area that's halfway between Hartford, you know, Hartford, Connecticut, and Providence, Rhode Island. And I would come across mill ponds that are just sitting there. And so I asked myself, well, what if you put some turbines on those mill ponds? Maybe get a little electricity out of them.
Yeah.
You see, there's a substantial dam network around Willimantic, Connecticut that was built by the Army Corps of Engineers. That's for flood purposes. How much power can you get out of that? You know, the water's just sitting there. I think that, it's in these small things that we can get off the carbon standard to some degree. Whatever we can do is going to be better than nothing.
Wow, that's a great phrase, the carbon standard.
Did I just make it up?
I don't know if you did, but I haven't heard it lately, and I think it's daggum brilliant.
Well, I was...
Yeah, because we thought, well, you know, we need to return the United States government to the gold standard, free silver, you know, all the...
We've never
had a gold standard. We've never had a silver standard. We exist on a carbon standard.
We do. It's disgusting. I mean, I see the ships coming in from abroad with oil in them. Right here, there's a refinery I can see out my living room window. It's the Chevron refinery. And we got four other refineries just in my county, you know, along the bay system. And there's one in the next county across the bay, across the water. And there's a lot of gasoline processing that's going on right around here. And we have a very high rate of asthma, and we've got a very high rate of cancer. And I'm always, because of my involvement with the health system, I'm always looking at that. And you know, we can live without it for so much. So, you know, we're talking about generation of electricity and movement by burning fossil fuels. And we're also harming people just by the processing of this crap, which you're familiar with, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I think that maybe small-time windmills, you know, not the big, it's not just the big wind farms. But
No, I'm a believer in both, okay? I believe in, there's that stupid stinking word I hate so much.
Which?
Believe.
Believe?
that thing causes more trouble. I mean, that's...
Doesn't it?
Yeah, that's like having a squirrel in your attic.
I'm an atheist.
Right, I try not to use that word believe where we're talking about fact-based stuff. I know that industrial wind can function very, very nicely in West Virginia. I also have a certain degree of respect for science and technology to figure out how to place the windmills in such a way. Yeah, I don't, honest to God, I don't know how many the ruby-throated nuthatches or fruit bats fly at 320 feet above mountaintops, but, you know, there you go.
Well, you know, that is a concern among, what would you call them, conservationists? I can't even, you know, we've got all these people. I don't know who these people are who want to restore Hetch Hetchy. I think it's a great idea. It's a nice idea. You know, they can hire the Walt Disney Corporation to come and terraform it back to what it looked like.
It's going to be a mess if you take the dam out.
It's rock down under there. They blasted it down to bedrock.
Sure.
As you would want them to do.
But what I'm getting at, though, is, you know, we can get around the objections of the people who are concerned about the birds. I like birds, too. I love birds. I heard the first bird the other day. I think I mentioned on the show Friday night. I heard the first bird out my window the other day. I was like, get out of here. You're not supposed to be here yet.
Yeah.
Anyway, I love them.
I think there's a simple solution to that. Put a shroud around the damn windmill, just like electric fans have on them to keep, you know, you don't want children poking their fingers into the fan blade, so you put a shroud around it. A screen design. So, you know, the birds will hit that, but they won't get sucked into the blades, for God's sake.
Yeah, and
this is so simple. So they'll lose maybe 4% of efficiency. So what?
But anyway, yeah, exactly. So we can have that. But I also am firmly convinced that there's a heck of a future in individual consumer-based wind and solar.
Oh yeah, you know, my relatives in West Virginia used to live on. I'm trying to remember the name of this. This road, you know, rural area outside, very close to Charleston. And there was a guy across the creek from them. And that, you know, that creek flooded like hell. He decided he was going to generate his own power. So he built a little tiny dam and put a dynamo in there. Very simple, backed up the creek a little bit, and he got himself some free power.
Yeah.
But then, you know, a flood came along.
Wiped it all out, sure.
Yeah, wiped it all out.
But there's, you know, there are downstream advantages to local wind and local solar or you know, home-based wind and solar.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is an entire sector of people who have to learn how to keep it in good repair. Because,
that's,
you know,
we're still
people who have to get up and go to work in the morning. We're talking about how we keep the lights on at night and how we keep the heat on in the winter and the cool in the summer. So that,
yeah,
you know, when we talk about that, we're talking about a real economic future. And if West Virginia could, or Appalachia in general could take advantage of some of that, you're talking about actually starting to have a real economy as opposed to this, mono economy that Scott and I were talking about in the first couple hours of the program.
Yeah.
And both of those can exist in harmony. And, in fact, the Public Service Commission here and in virtually every other state, if I understand correctly, has within the power company tariffs a mandate, actually, that if you generate electricity, you get to sell it back to the power company, and they don't have a choice. They have to buy it from you.
Well, we've got that here. But there's a catch. The Pacific Gas and Electric Company is an incredible monolith that supplies most of the state with its power. And, you know, we're all captives to these guys. And they have done some pretty nasty things. Well, there was that movie that was made about them, Aaron Brockovich.
Yeah.
You know, just for starters. But they have tried to wiggle their way out. And one thing they're allowed, yeah, they got to buy it. But if you are selling them power, they don't have to pay you when the year is up. It's like a goddamn cell phone contract, you know?
Oh, no, they take it out in trade. Yeah, they'll balance it against, for instance, any usage coming from them. See,
But at the end of the year, whatever credits you have are gone. They wipe out.
Oh, they don't. Oh, there's no carryover.
There's no carryover.
I'll be damned.
You lose it.
Well, these are the things that have to have the skull sweat applied to them.
Oh, yeah.
I've looked around, Richard, because, you know, I would be willing to make this operation a sort of experimental subject. If there was some foundation, some organization out there that wanted to prove the viability of individually based wind and solar. I'm sitting here. I've got a beautiful southern exposure. I got nice winds. It's West Virginia. You know, I was traveling not quite a year ago I think I told the story on air of my crazy ass decision to come back via US 33 from Washington DC and wound up climbing up over the Eastern Continental Divide. Which, you know, while it ain't exactly the High Sierra, is still pretty high. I mean, you know, there it was, April, and we were driving through, and we just got 3 inches of snow pelted on us coming down the downside. It was a little creepy. But we got up to the Eastern Continental Divide, and the person I was traveling with said, "Look." And we looked up at the highest part of the mountain, and there is an individual wind turbine, not an industrial wind turbine by any stretch of the imagination, just an individual wind turbine spinning like a carnival pinwheel.
Oh, isn't that nice?
And it was so inspiring. And not too far from here at the Beckley campus of the, it's called the Irma Bird Center. It's named after Senator Bird's late wife. Appalachian Power has an installation. Dr. Bill O'Brien's told me about this. And, you can see it every, and these individual, these smaller wind turbines are really cool because they're on swivels.
Yeah.
In other words, they will spin to whatever direction the wind is coming from through 360 degrees. And anytime you drive by there, it sits hard by the interstate. Anytime you drive by there, that thing is spinning like a carnival pinwheel. And they've got a solar panel as well. And, you know, I think I've recounted this as well. Makes me crazy. I was talking to Bill, and I said, you know, oh, Bill, that's great, man. I'm so glad they put that in here. That shows for the, well, he said, don't get too excited, Bob. I said, why not? He says, it's not generating anything.
Why?
I said, what? He said, yeah, Appalachian Power installed it there, but it's only gathering data. Then, you know, that's when I started with the Yosemite Sam's. Blag, staggin, not pole, frazzle, lackin, bison, narkin.
Well, I guess we have to.
But it works!
You know, let's say we've got two different frontal attacks here, you know. One is the technology, and the other one is the status quo, who are going to fight to preserve what they've got. And they're standing in our way, which is no surprise to anybody listening to the horn. But this, you know, I mean, we haven't been talking about community-based energy. Now, I saw something like that. Went to Troy, Montana, with my kid. You know, I had a wife at the time. So my, you know, a family trip.
Mm-hmm.
We had somebody to visit in Troy, Montana. Where's Troy, Montana? It's up by the Canadian border. Small town. And what I noticed was there was a dam right there, and it was crumbling. Well, at one time, they had had a local power company, right? The power company was bought up and bought up again and again and again, just like the banks right now. But at one time, they were generating enough electricity out of that dam to take care of a lot of people's needs.
Well, look at the Tennessee Valley Authority, Richard.
Yeah.
An idea born of great good intent.
Right.
That really, really worked. I mean, a massive industry was attracted to the area where I grew up, and which I still cherish. You know, there in the last little foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. The Shoals area of Alabama. Ford was there. Union Carbide was there. Turned into a horrible polluter. Reynolds Metals was there. TVA was there in its own right. And it was all based on a system of hydroelectric dams, that provided cheap, efficient, almost infinitely available electricity. And at the same time, relieve the region of a lot of problems. I mean, we don't think about it, but, for instance, going back to the founding days of this nation, Philadelphia went through repeated bouts of yellow fever. Well, so did the area where I grew up until the dams came along. And it put that and the programs that came along with it put paid to a lot of that, put a lot of that to rest. But then as soon as the prophet mongers, the followers of Holy Prophet with an F and an I, as soon as they realized that, hey, there's a dollar in this, well, they got their fingers into the pie via the government because it was run by the government. That's supposedly still is.
Yeah.
But, you know, look what they did to Kingston, Tennessee. And they left the hydroelectric mission. First, they left it in favor of coal-fired power plants. And then later on, it was deemed by, you know, a profit-centered industry that, you know, the TVA would be a great place for some nuclear plants.
Mm.
And so TVA crippled itself on nuclear power. And the next thing you know, the prices go up, and that huge economic boom that was created via the industry coming to the valley dried up and disappeared because it was no longer inexpensive. And the next thing you know, Reynolds Metals is in Venezuela.
And you said something about the private sector getting in on this. How did that happen?
Well, look, somebody's got to build the nuclear reactors.
Okay, so they're selling nuclear power plants.
Yeah, to TVA.
They may have maintenance contracts as well.
Right.
And
And, you know, the river is a part of, you know, going back to my conversation with Scott, and this was well before the Clean Water Act, but still, the river is part of the waters of the United States. And
yeah.
It was there to be used. However, when TVA expanded into coal-fired power plants, guess what they had to do? They had to buy coal on the free market.
Oh, yeah.
So that, you know, so bang, they're into, because the whole point, once TVA was conceived, the thing that followed on it was the followers of Holy Prophet looking at it and realizing that, well, if it's going to exist, we have to find some way to make money for it, for ourselves out of it.
Yeah,
and then you insinuate executives into the. You know what we need? We need some coal-fired power plants. That's what we need. We're gonna put one down Cherokee, Alabama. We're gonna put one in Kingston, Tennessee. We're gonna have coal-fired power plants all of the same. And you know, we can just it'll be like cookie cutters. We put one here. It's the same. The same.
Yeah. This is. I mean, I see this in this health system I'm involved with. You know, I think that we're too expensive. You see, and I'm always looking at, well, what's going on here? And I see that we are using an entire rate structure that is obtained from the private sector.
There you go.
We use the same computer systems they do, and talking about software now, because it's there, it's on the market, and we have to interface with these guys. Because let's say I'm in Charleston, West Virginia, and I get hit by a truck, you know. And so I have to be able to go to Charleston General or whatever the name of the hospital is. So my health system has to have all these interrelated agreements and brokered contracts and stuff like that. So, you know, if you have an HMO, even though we're public, we still have to interface all over the place and use the standards of the private sector, and this is what's really bugging me.
And right, and the next thing you know, you're collapsing the system.
Yeah, so you know...
Not because of the failure of the public aspect of the project, but because of the necessary interface with the private profit-driven aspect.
Exactly, and so, you know, maybe this happened with TVA to some degree, too. You've just explained to me the metamorphosis of the thing from good intentions to crap, you know.
Crap ruined by people who were hell-bent on dragging profit out of it.
Yeah. Now, you know, I almost started by talking about the Hetch Hetchy project, and that is corrupt. What happened was the water – see, the enabling legislation is called the Raker Act, and it said that they'll give San Francisco this hunk of Yosemite National Park. In return, San Francisco has to deliver electricity and water to its citizens without profit, without any private intermediary. So what happened, the water is done that way, but not the electricity. Their electric wires come all the way to Newark, California, which is on the bay, and they stop. The city's wires do not extend anywhere near San Francisco. Pacific Gas and Electric buys the power wholesale and retails it to San Francisco. And as far now, San Francisco has electric transit vehicles. To give you an example, it's got light rail, streetcars. It's got electric buses. They're very good for climbing hills. And there was a third thing. The cable cars. Awesome.
Sure.
The cable cars are dragged up and down the hills by one 600-horsepower electric motor. Isn't that mind-boggling?
Yeah.
The efficiency of that. All the cable
right, and this is not new technology.
Well, cable cars are dangerous. That's a whole other thing. They can't really be made safe or efficient.
No. But I mean, but this is relatively done technology. That's the thing that I keep trying to get out there into the sort of into the universe. We're not talking. I mean, we're talking about refinements to existing technologies, but we're not talking about inventing new technologies.
Right,
whereas,
exactly.
If you compare.
I love it.
Whereas if you compare that with something like so-called clean coal, we're talking about invented technologies that do not presently exist, that tremendous resources are going to have to be poured into to create.
Yeah. Well, I went out and interviewed with U.S. Wind Power. Oh, boy, it must have been 18 years ago. They were in Livermore, California. And they were participating in wind farms in the Altamont Pass, which is a very, very windy piece of real estate. And the story was really fantastic. A bunch of doctors invested in this company, U.S. Wind Power, and they wanted to use it as a tax loss. So these guys were building windmills. Of course, they were taking it seriously. The doctors weren't.
Right.
And what happened was they started making money. You know, and the whole idea was...
And the doctors went,
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And what these windmills were, you know, they were the sort of thing that you see, two blades and, you know, a tower. But in the base of that tower was an old-fashioned IBM PC computer with an 8088 processing chip. You know, the original IBM.
Yeah.
With a little software, and so that was controlling each windmill had one of those boards in it, and they were actually, the state mandated that PG&E had to buy the electricity, and it was working. And I'm sorry I never went to work for these guys.
Well, Richard, I've got to close this off because we're right on top of the end of the show, but this has been a wonderful conversation. I'm glad that last couple of times you've called, we haven't had so much time to talk, but this was a lot of fun.
Great. Well, I hope the people didn't get inconvenienced.
Oh, no. That's what this is for.
Okay.
Richard, take care, and we will talk soon.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Calling from California, our friend Richard. We got to two calls tonight. They were two magnificent phone calls. I hope they were as engaging to you as they were to me. With that in mind, tell me where else you can hear the expertise that is brought to bear on this program, on this network, because this sort of thing happens on all the shows. Where can you hear that? Anywhere else? If there is somewhere else, it is a profoundly limited universe of availability. With that in mind, I have to renew the request. Thank those who contribute to keeping this going. And renew the request for those who have not yet. Your help to keep this going is much needed, however you can. And however you do, We appreciate it. With that in mind, we thank you for all that you do that makes this such a wonderful experiment. So thank you. Thank you to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, to Ben Birch, the most overworked man in liberal talk who literally saved the genre starting in 2002 with WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thank you to Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and CoalRiverWind.org. The work that Coal River Mountain Watch does is stunning. And it is done selflessly, and it is done heroically. And I am forever an admirer. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to another wonderful week of Conversation Radio on the Horn. This is live. This is as real as it gets. I'm Bob Kincaid. And there are a number of directions in which to go this evening. Some things that are speaking to me to one degree or another. You know, things speak to me, me being a recovering Southern Baptist and all. Sorry, no. This isn't Wednesday. This is Monday. No speaking in tongues. But you get the idea. What's speaking to me this evening? Well, there's a little matter of a law that needs to be taken off the books. I'd say that things are going from worse to worser in places like Pakistan. The Republican level of irrelevance is reaching redefined levels. Not sure if you'd call them high or low, so we'll just call them levels. I mean, when you got to bring Dan Aykroyd back to Saturday Night Live to play John Boner in a skit. Well. Ah, that was a strange and odd little skit to open Saturday Night Live.